That's finance come to order. It's 8:48 a.m. Excuse me. The 17th.
Thank you, Miss.
Time to go.
Anybody's free to leave. We have today a presentation by Mr. Pursley on Alaska natural gas and the viability of it. I think is the general term. At least the economic viability, market viability. We have members present: Representative Guttenberg, Representative Guerra, Representative Costello Stoltz, Co-Chair Osterman, Representative Edgman, and Thompson. Other members arriving as I speak. Munoz, we have a quorum to do business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the committee for the opportunity to come here today. For the record, I'm Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Gas Line Projects, depending what happens on our budget for the next fiscal year. But today, I guess I'd like to present to the committee that this Alaska Gas Line project, where it stands in a competitive marketplace, and that it actually is possible that this could be one of the winners in that competitive marketplace. I'm certainly not here to pass federal judgment on state actions, but I do want to leave you start with a couple thoughts before I get into the presentation. I guess what I'm going to tell you today is what could be in terms of where Alaska stands in the market, but also to be careful because LNG projects are a high-stake business. Speaking as a federal official, though, I will tell you that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, Bureau of Land Management, and others certainly have a lot of work on their desks without this project. There are close to a dozen LNG export projects at different stages of the process with FERC. The Department of Energy has 25 applications waiting for a decision on LNG export approval, but I met just last week with the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Energy, and I can tell you that federal agencies are aware of what's happening in Alaska and are willing and eager to work on it. That your problem is the market, not with the federal government. I say that a little defensive about being a Fed in Alaska, but I take it well. So in terms of the project, really the world has changed. Nothing's changed about Alaska gas, and we could be, as I call it, in a position to be a victor of circumstances. That Asian demand alone for LNG could double by 2025, a lot of that driven by economic growth, industrial activity in China, and also worldwide concerns over pollution from coal and fear of nuclear power plants. One other point is a lot of the LNG in the world is coming from older projects. A couple examples in Egypt and Indonesia. Egypt has been exporting gas only since 2005. And because of declining production and increasing domestic demand and some political problems in Egypt, they this year are going to have to import LNG. They don't have enough to meet their own demands and their full export delivery quotas. Indonesia is also a long-time supplier. In fact, at one point, Indonesia was the world's largest supplier of LNG exports. And now with increasing domestic demand and declining production, as we're familiar with from Prudhoe Bay, Indonesia, those two needs are competing against each other. So as you look at where you might sell gas, it's not just growth, but it's also picking up some contracts or customers as some of the older projects decline in their future reserves. Certainly the growth in LNG demand globally is what is attracting tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars of worldwide investment in export projects. The global LNG import demand last year totaled about 32 billion cubic feet a day, a substantial amount of gas. Just to put in some perspective, though, that gas that moved as liquefied natural gas around the world was only about 10% of global natural gas consumption. About 90%, close to 90% of gas consumed in the world moves by pipeline, most of that domestically, and some by pipeline between countries. Europe buys liquefied natural gas, South America, other areas, but certainly everyone is focused on Asia. These five countries accounted for 70% of global demand, in 2012. There's a lot of talk about Japan certainly shutting down all their nuclear, buying a lot of LNG, but their real growth potential is in China. In December of last year, China's natural gas demand, LNG imports, was up 20% year-on-year from December 2012 to December 2013. China does have a lot of shale gas reserves. They have not really proven them up. They haven't done much exploration. One problem they have is much of their shale is in arid, dry areas of the nation, and you need a lot of water for hydraulic fracturing. So their shale is in the wrong spot from that perspective. It's going to make it much more difficult and harder to get to. Again, just focusing on China for one last minute, you can see in 2013, China produces, and for a number of years, produced more than enough gas to meet its own demand. As their economy started building, they were not able to keep up. Last year, they needed to import more than 4.5 billion cubic feet a day, and that is growing by substantial numbers. A chart like that certainly makes gas sellers happy. China roughly imports about half its gas, or half of the gas it imports comes by LNG tanker, the other half by pipeline. The pipeline gas is no bargain. It's not like buying it in Louisiana or Texas. Last year, China paid on average almost $10 per 1,000 cubic feet for pipeline gas from Turkmenistan, more than $10 for gas from Uzbekistan, and about $12 per 1,000 cubic feet for gas by pipeline from Myanmar. And that was only to the border. Then there were additional charges to bring it actually to the cities and to the customer in China. So as you look at supplying there, yes, you have competition from pipeline gas, but no, it is not cheap pipeline gas. Certainly this chart, my point of this is to illustrate really what changed. For years, you could not have taken North Slope gas, piped it to Tidewater, liquefied it, which is very expensive, and sent it by ship to Japan and paid your bills. Prices pretty much tracked the rest of the world. 5-6 years ago, prices started splitting off, and Japan now is the, or Asia, certainly the profit opportunity for LNG exports. But I guess I'd like to show this with a warning. Don't assume that today's $17 and $18 prices for LNG will continue forever. There's too much new supply coming on, too much pressure. Most analysts expect the gap to continue, just not as wide as it's been, but wide enough to still make a profit. So with all of the demand, all of the growth, there's certainly enough business to share. There are about a dozen LNG export projects under construction around the world, but that's not the end of the story. You could face another, or the world could need another 10 or 12 in the next 10 to 15 years. Hundreds of billions of dollars in investments, but it's going to come down to price competitiveness. And that's where Alaska hopefully will have a chance. I should say price isn't going to be everything, but it's going to be most everything. You know, Japan last year paid more than $70 billion for its LNG imports. That's a big reason for the huge trade gap. After 3 decades of trade surpluses, Japan has faced a trade deficit the last 3 years in a row, thanks in great part to expensive LNG at higher volumes with the shutdown of nuclear. Japan, India, and other countries are really pushing for a new pricing regime, new suppliers, more competition, but they acknowledge, and certainly the project developers keep reminding them, because of the heavy upfront cost of an LNG export project, prices have to be high enough to justify the investment. In terms of what we're competing against, yes, for the record, no one else that I know of has an 800-mile pipeline to get to Tidewater. Doesn't mean they're short pipelines. British Gas Group, BG Group, wants to build an export terminal in Prince Rupert. They need to build more than a 500-mile pipeline to get there, and their officials have said that could cost up to $10 billion, similar to ours. The project developers, and there are multiple, there's 13 different proposals in British Columbia alone for export projects, though no one expects anywhere close to that number to be built. The provincial government just last month came out with its proposed net income tax on LNG exports, which after a project developer recovers their capital expense, that provincial tax would ramp up to 7% on net. I guess the nice way to put it is the industry is not feeling the love in British Columbia. They are not happy about the tax proposal, and other projects around the world have their own problems, some very high development costs in Australia. Given all the potential new supplies coming on, a lot of buyers are holding back. They still prefer long-term contracts, but you see several signing some short-term deals as they wait for pricing to settle down to a new regime. Focusing a little bit on each of the countries, Canada certainly is eager. Like I said, there's 13 proposals. First Nations consultations are not going to be easy. A lot of issues to deal with on pipeline routing, air quality in particular. At Kitimat, B.C., like Juneau, it's in a narrow channel, and the residents in that area are concerned about air quality. As I said, pipelines, they've got to go through two mountain ranges, Rocky Mountain and Coast Mountain, to get to the coast. One of the routes into Prince Rupert to avoid Salmon River would go offshore, and their choice on pipeline routing is to either go offshore and go through an old mine tailings disposal site or to cross a mollusk habitat rearing bed on the ocean floor, neither of which are great options, certainly. Canada, the projects there are also finding, as we have learned here, pre-FEED and FEED are expensive. Apache is a 50% partner with Chevron in a proposed LNG project at Kitimat. Apache's coming share of FEED is about $1 billion, and Apache has said they'd like to sell off some of their stake. They can't afford the $1 billion, or choose not to spend the $1 billion would probably be a better way to put it. In terms of taxes, the provincial government has said what the rates will be. They have not offered the details. They will not offer the details and the legislation until fall of this year, and British Columbia's regulatory regime for LNG projects will not come out till next year. What that has done is delayed final investment decisions. The Chevron Apache Kitimat project has said 2016 for final investment decision. BG Group, which wants to build one at Rupert, has put off their final investment decision until 2017. Lower 48, like I said, the Department of Energy has 25 export applications waiting for decision. Tough politics in the lower 48. You've got a lot of buyers who like an oversupplied market with all that shale gas is holding prices down, but certainly producers and export project developers would like the free market to take over and find a place to sell that gas. In terms of U.S. Gulf Coast projects, those ships are going to have to go through the Panama Canal to get to Asia. The Panama Canal is being expanded, widened, and deepened. They are facing $1.6 billion in cost overruns and a one-year delay in completion, and nobody knows for sure what the tolls are going to be for going through the canal. That is causing some concern on the part of Asian buyers. The tolls and when that opens up are certainly key to signing supply contracts with Gulf Coast suppliers. In addition to the Gulf Coast, there are export terminals proposed for Chesapeake Bay and the coast of Oregon, and you can imagine what kind of environmental opposition they are facing in those locations. I would not suggest investing in them. So I probably shouldn't say that as a government official. So,
I just moved the market.
I think the market has looked at those. The one in Chesapeake Bay is not more than an hour drive from Washington, D.C., and they're having very intense local opposition, though there has been an LNG import terminal at the site since the 1970s. It was sort of out of sight, out of mind, not very controversial. A lot of the opposition in the lower 48 to export terminals is not to the liquefaction plant or to the ships, but it comes from opponents of hydraulic fracturing, which would be the source of the shale gas to feed the terminals, kind of like Keystone oil pipelines. Not so much the oil line, as opponents don't like the oil sands in Alberta. Australia, where there are seven projects that are under construction, is facing tremendous cost overruns, and investors are getting scared when those seven are done. They're not sure they want to invest in others. And as Australia shifts into this new world order, they will probably be the world's largest LNG exporter before the end of the decade, overtaking Qatar from the Mideast in that role. it's driving up the price for domestic gas. Because, of course, if you're a producer and you can get a higher price sending it overseas, you're not necessarily going to sell it for the old low price domestically, and that has caused a lot of political consternation and talk of shortages and problems in Australia. Half of the projects under construction will be supplied by coalbed gas, which has some of its own local environmental opposition. In terms of Russia, Russia has had one LNG project operating for 5 years at Sakhalin Island. It's a partnership of Gazprom and Shell. There is one being constructed on the Yamal Peninsula in the Arctic, which has its own problems. It's way at the top of Russia. It's about halfway between Iceland and Nome, if you can kind of picture that out in the middle of nowhere. Their plan is during the summer, with the help of government-provided nuclear-powered icebreakers, they'll take the short route to Asia, the Northern Sea route. But again, they still have to have the government-subsidized icebreakers with them. The rest of the year, they can't make it on the short route. So their business plan has them using ice-class tankers running west.
Excuse me. Oil spill. Well, keep going.
Do you need a containment boom?
I was so riveted by your testimony. Perhaps,
Mr. Chairman, we should call DEC for the hazmat team?
I don't have that kind of money.
Good answer. So the rest of the year, they will run an ice-class tanker west to Europe, transfer the LNG to a standard tanker, which will then take it the rest of the way around Europe through the Mediterranean, down through the Suez Canal, Indian Ocean, into Asia. A very long trip. Many people look at it and question the economics, but with Russia, economics don't really matter. It's just the politics that drive the decision. There is one other project that's proposed in Russia at Vladivostok on the Pacific coast, but to get the gas there, they need to build a 2,500-mile pipeline. The pipeline and field development costs are estimated at $40 billion, not counting the liquefaction plant. So getting back to Alaska for the last few slides, we have a lot of advantages. Yes, we have the 800-mile pipelines with high construction costs, but proven reserves, as we know, producers have been reinjecting that gas, and it's there. An LNG ship, an LNG carrier, runs on a daily rate $75,000 to $100,000 a day. A run from Nikiski to Japan, 7 days, maybe 8 days, that's one-third the time from the Gulf Coast, and even bigger savings from Qatar in the Mideast. The savings from running a much shorter voyage are substantial. And as Steve Butt from ExxonMobil, the Alaska LNG team, has explained, the liquefaction plant at Nikiski will run a lot more efficiently than in the U.S. Gulf Coast, same equipment, or in the Mideast. You get up to 15% more LNG from the same gas going in. And Alaska gas, because of the ethane in it, has the perfect high BTU content for the Japanese market. So while the market has changed in our favor in the last several years, certainly Alaska has changed too. Going forward, Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope, the economics there just look much better if it's an oil and gas play rather than oil only. And as someone who's followed it for a long time, I can't tell you, I have not seen the companies willing to spend this much money to advance an LNG project before. I will say, though, and maybe we need a special license plate, that patience is a virtue, particularly on LNG projects. As you've been hearing this session, a long lead time. A lot of people like to point to Norway, where they do take an equity stake in projects, but people should remember Norway invested billions in oil and gas and then waited years for any money to come back, and a decade before they really started seeing a substantial profit on that money they had put in. If we're going to act like an oil and gas business, the state has to think long-term and be patient. I am not aware, I will say, of any LNG export project that has been built that has lost money. Certainly there have been some where a lot of money was spent on development, pre-development costs that didn't get built and that got written off. But as far as an export project that got actually, they went, developers went ahead and built it. I'm not aware, and I have not been able to find any that have lost money. I will address in just the last couple slides. In 2002, when I was deputy commissioner at the Department of Revenue, we wrote a report that looked at the risks and rewards of state ownership in a gas line. Some differences, though, that looked at a pipeline, not an LNG project, different markets, different sales terms, different regulations between interstate, regulated interstate pipe and export projects. For those who were involved in the Fiscal Policy Council of 2001-2002, they'll remember 2002, the state was down to its last $2 billion. We were talking about where you could borrow money if you had to cover bills. Today, certainly, with $17 billion in savings, a much different cash position for the state, though I fully admit a lot of those savings will be needed to balance the budget in the next several years ahead. Because of the lack of savings, the report discussed the politics, the problems, the investment troubles of actually going to the permanent fund for investment in the pipeline, and we also looked at 100% state ownership, smaller percentages too, but discussed how the state or if the state or what would be the problems of actually doing the whole thing. Some things have not changed since the 2002 report. The report recommended that if the state was going to own part of the project, that it match its gas, percentage of gas, with the percentage of ownership of the project, so you're moving your own gas through your own portion. We had substantial concerns about potential conflicts as an owner and a regulator of the same asset. The report did talk about how you could minimize that to some extent by having a partial barrier, setting up a separate corporation in the middle to hold the state's interests. And two warnings, I guess, that we stated rather strongly in the report: people should not think that becoming a partner gives you control over the project unless you own 51%, which the state clearly could not afford then and probably can't afford now, and that we need to keep politics out of business decisions. In my final slide, certainly I'm not minimizing the risks or how big of a step this would be for Alaska to invest billions in a project like this. Again, I think people need to, in the public, they need to realize, yes, you get a voice by being a partner, but you don't get to control all the other voices, and you're going to make probably, likely, hopefully, a very healthy return on your investment, but concurrent with that comes the risks of making a business investment, and that it takes substantial money through pre-feed and feed to get to a point where you can make a final investment decision. There's no other way to get there other than spending their money. So before I take questions, I guess I'd close by saying it's this is possible within the market. I think Alaska could compete on price in the LNG market. We need to be careful not to fall in love too much counting the dollars till we learn more through the pre-feed and feed. And then as Alaskans judge whether this is a good investment, judge it not just on possible potential modeled out forecast public revenues, but certainly the value to Alaskans of having gas available in-state at affordable rates, and the value to Alaskans that if the companies commit to a $40 or $50 billion investment on the North Slope to last decades, that is a commensurate commitment to keep North Slope oil operations running that long, too, and you get a lot more money from oil than you do gas. But the extending the longevity of North Slope operations certainly is a huge benefit to the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pursley. I think I'm dried up now. So the two phrases you used were cost competitiveness, we'll decide the winners, and price is everything. I guess you went through the multiple slides and you had different factors. Can you just summarize again why Alaska can compete on the world market against all these other markets, and what are our advantages? Again, can you just re-summarize, or just re-recapsulate those?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz. And just to clarify, these are my impressions. I'm not speaking off any proprietary numbers from,
well,
from the
companies.
Well,
if we didn't value your impressions, okay, you wouldn't be sitting here this morning along
okay
with us.
Thank you. So the advantages are a lot shorter tanker runs on a very expensive ship. So whether you're chartering the ship or whether you're tying up your own capital and owning it yourself, if you can do a three-week turnaround between cargoes as opposed to a two-month turnaround, you're going to get a lot more value out of that ship. I think that's a significant advantage. The much higher efficiency running the liquefaction plant in a cold climate gives you a substantial advantage. You pay less and get more LNG out at the other end. I think the fact that it is proven reserves is also a substantial advantage. Some of these projects, like in Australia, the three coal seam gas fed projects are all finding that their supplies are coming up short, and they're going to have to buy gas from third parties at least for the first year of their LNG plant operations to fulfill their contractual commitments. Well, that's not going to be cheap gas. So you know the gas is there. It's being produced. You don't have exploration and production costs. In some of the remote shale fields in British Columbia, they don't have a Prudhoe Bay that brings up the gas every day. They're going to have to build the Prudhoe Bay out in those remote areas, and that's going to have to be charged against the gas project. It's not like it's been paid off by oil over the years. So lower cost feed gas coming in, certainly from Prudhoe, shorter tanker runs, more efficient operations, and Alaska is a proven producer. ConocoPhillips plant's been delivering LNG since 1969. The Asian market values that. You know, they look at Russia, and even though Russia has a lot of gas and certainly the political ability to put together a project, it doesn't have this. We joke about Alaska being a little squirrely on politics, which is a nice way of putting it, but we're nothing compared to Putin. Customers don't worry about us like they do heating their homes on gas that's dependent on the whims of Russia. So you look at all those, and can they overcome the cost of that 800-mile pipeline and the fact it costs more to build here? I think it can. There are a lot of analysts who think it can. You won't know until there's a wide range, $45 to $65 billion, after pre-feed and feed, when you have a better sense where within that range it comes and you actually get prices. What's it going to cost to treat the gas, pipe the gas to Nikiski, liquefy it, and you can see what price you can offer in Asia and whether you can sign up enough customers.
So, and just one last question. There are several people. Our governor keeps a shirt on in public and supports a stable tax policy. Those seem to be the larger two of the big differences. And how does tax policy figure into the viability and how the markets treat our proposal?
Mr. Chairman, certainly, as British Columbia pointed out, there's probably not a tax regime anywhere in the world that the oil and gas industry loves. In British Columbia, what they have proposed, rather than a state participation or equity, they have proposed a new net income tax on LNG exports, but they allow the companies to recover all their capital up front. After cost recovery on that capital expense, then the tax starts ramping up, starts at 1% and goes to 7%. They went a different way. Companies are certainly concerned about 7% being too high, and as many discussions in Alaska have turned on, when you allow deductions, then you argue over what's an allowable deduction. So I'm not sure that the British Columbia process is that perfect either. There's tax battles underway on LNG in Israel, which has a huge offshore field, and elsewhere. Yes, stability is important. But I think the industry realizes that they realize they have to pay tax, but I guess the stability is, so when they pencil it out, they know what the tax bill is going to be, because they can't sign a 20-year contract with Tokyo Electric and then have a substantial tax increase halfway through it. Tokyo Electric is not going to pay more for gas just because Alaska raised its taxes. It's going to have to come out of the pocket of the seller, and that's what worries them.
And I said two, but I just, one last quick one. Do you think you follow Alaska politics? Do we have the patience necessary to make a good political patience necessary to make a good business decision?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Well, I like to criticize the Alaska public. I guess I'm not running for office.
No, this is the legislature and the public collectively, the whole government politic, body politic. They're one and the same here, practically.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it's going to be Alaskans are going to have to work really hard to learn patience on this, that you're going to go through years of writing checks for pre-feed and feed and construction and procurement, and it's going to take several years before the money comes back. The nice thing about LNG projects, and one of the reasons the oil and gas industry likes them, along with huge oil finds, is once you get it going, it's a very predictable, a very level, a very long-term cash flow coming in. And certainly 20, 25, 30, 40, 50, Alaskans will need that money. We're going to have to work hard to learn the patience to wait till then if this is the route that the
state
goes.
Hypothetically, maybe wait a year or two to increase pre-K and things like that. Just move on.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if we want to talk about pre-K, I can give you the federal opinion on pre-K.
Right from Michelle's mouth, right? Thank you.
And the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Representative Costello, then Osterman,
Mr.
then
Mr. President, I won't use that as a segue into my questions. I won't be talking about education today. I mean this morning.
This morning.
Yeah,
just
this morning. On slide four, I wanted to just comment on how astounding that slide is. And do you see that trend continuing? Or do you see the deficit there leveling off?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I guess I see it continuing. I don't know if it continue growing exponentially like this. China has wretched, miserable air pollution problems from coal. So I guess politically, you know, how many Chinese is the government willing to kill in the pursuit of cheap energy? They're facing a lot of political problems over pollution. And like I said, they do have some pipeline gas options, but they're not cheap. Another pipeline gas option would be buying from Russia. I don't think China really wants to stake its economic future in a partnership with Russia. So I think this will continue growing. I think they're going to have problems developing shale. It may not grow as steeply. China's a big nation, a lot of industrial activity, and they like big projects, and LNG import terminals are big projects. China also wants to get into the LNG shipbuilding business. They have made a requirement on some of the new contracts. If you're going to bring gas into there, they want you to build ships there. They see this as a long-term part of their economic plan.
Their own version of the Chen Act, right?
Want to sell to us, you have to buy from us.
Mr. Persley, is there any effort then to outfit their coal plants with clean coal technology?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, they are, but as we've learned in this country, there's a limit as to how clean you can make coal. And it's also costly. If you can get a good price on gas, not $20, but if you can get $10 and $12 gas, it makes more sense than trying to clean coal, because once you go with that gas plant, you're safe for decades. Today's clean coal may not be clean enough 10 years from now.
And then on page 10, or slide 10, one of the bullets talks about the Energy Department export approvals are slow. And I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Paula Gant recently from the Department of Energy. And in her remarks that she made at an energy presentation, she mentioned the term public confidence at least half a dozen times in response to the role of the federal government in permitting and approvals. And what concerns me about that is that we do have regulations on the books that ensure environmentally safe practices, but now there's this new bar of having to meet some new standard that she was not able to explain what that was. And could you talk about any delays that we might anticipate with that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Costello. The biggest delay that LNG export projects are facing in the lower 48 is you need Department of Energy approval, authorization, to export natural gas to countries that we don't have free trade treaties with, which include China and Japan as two big ones. For decades, other than the Conoco plant in Nikiski, there were none. It wasn't a problem. There was a little small office at the Department of Energy, Office of Fossil Energy, and they routinely approved pipeline requests to move oil and gas between the U.S. and Canada and the Conoco plant. With all the production of shale gas, and they got deluged with more than 30 applications, many of which were companies that had invested billions of dollars in LNG import terminals in the last decade that were sitting there gathering dust because no one was importing gas anymore because we had so much shale gas. They wanted to salvage what they could of their investment and get in the export trade. Those are going slowly. There's a very contentious debate in the lower 48 about what to do with our natural gas wealth. I think fortunately for Alaska, that debate won't extend up here, because by exporting North Slope gas, you're not denying it to Detroit or Des Moines or Dubuque, because there's no way to get there. So hopefully, if Alaska LNG applies for export licenses, as they've indicated they would at some point, I don't think we will get caught up in that lower 48 debate, because it's not taking gas that could be used in the lower 48. It's conventional gas. It's not from hydraulic fracturing or shale, so we shouldn't get caught up in that environmental debate. So I don't see, and in conversations I've had at Interior and other agencies, no one has said, here's a permit that's going to stop this project. That's not to say there won't be contentious debates and complaining and letters back and forth, but I haven't seen one that's going to stop it. It's a buried pipeline. They've built a lot of them.
Thank you. That's a refreshing answer, and I have one final question. How important is the high BTU content in terms of this project? I mean, how valuable is that?
Well, through the chair, Representative Costello, in Japan, their generators are set to burn a higher BTU value. If you took that gas and tried to put it in your home range here, you'd have real safety problems, but that's what they're calibrated for. The mixture coming off the North Slope after years of gas cycling, taking out some of the heavier natural gas liquids and putting them in taps, has left a gas stream that should fit perfectly the Japanese market. That's an advantage, because if they buy, in the case of the coal bed methane gas from Australia, it's going to be too low of a BTU content. They're going to have to pay additional money to spike it with propane or something to get it to their BTU value. So in that sense, Alaska Gas, it's another advantage, through the chair, that we have over others, having the right gas for the right market.
Thank you.
Representative Wasserman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, Larry, I'm a little bit out of my element when I'm talking about gas and oil. As you know, I can talk to you about fish oil, but the rest of this stuff is...
You almost talked about a Kodiak gas line on the floor the other day.
Yeah. But a little bit I've read raises a little bit of concern with me in reference to what the cost of the Alaska pipeline, $45 to $65 billion, figure that keeps on throwing around out there. You're talked at one about one plant here at $10 billion. So what's the gas gets to Tidewater and is liquefied and is in a tanker, and we know what the price is at that point in time of what we can sell it at and make a profit. The discussion in reference to that I've read in reference to most long-term contracts are tied to the price of gas is tied to oil. And if I understand correctly, with the price of the gas in the lower 48, which is not tied to oil, as most of the long-term contract negotiations are going to go on about breaking that tie to oil. Give us a sense of where you think the price structure is going to be, where it becomes viable that these markets that are looking for lower price gas, obviously, and are going to want it, where does that place us with what our cost is going to be compared to probably costs that are coming from other producers across the nation or the world?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, again, I don't have precise numbers from the companies as to what they think it's going to cost to liquefy, but clearly, everything I've seen, it will cost more to liquefy the gas than it will to pipe it down from the North Slope. Liquefaction is a very expensive process. So looking at the U.S. Gulf Coast, for example, currently it's close to $5 per 1,000 cubic feet if you were to buy gas in the U.S. at Henry Hub, which is the pricing point. At that price, there is one plant under construction at Sabine Pass, Louisiana, Cheniere Energy. They expect to be sending out the first cargoes by 2016. Under the contracts they have signed to take gas through their plant, they're just a toll booth. They're not a producer. They're just running the liquefaction factory, and you pay them a fee. The cost for gas out of there would be the $5 plus 15% more for the gas they're going to burn, plus $3 for the liquefaction charges, plus the tanker charges to get from the U.S. Gulf to Asia. At the $5 price, that gas could cost close to $12 by the time it's landed. Yes, a lot of the buyers would like to be delinked or softened from the pricing linkage to oil, but they look at U.S. prices, which are very volatile. During some bad stretches this winter, spot prices in the U.S. were close to $8 per 1,000 cubic feet. That $8 gas, by the time you liquefied it and sent it to Asia, would have been 15 to 16 landed. So buyers are looking for something cheaper but without volatility. So 100% linked to U.S. prices brings them into a very volatile market that worries them a little bit. I think long-term in Asia, the alternative is still oil. You can burn diesel or you can burn natural gas, but you got to run the generator. So I think it will stay linked but have some sort of a hybrid pricing or maybe linked to oil. And you saw this on some of the older contracts. It was linked on a BTU equivalent basis to oil since that's your alternative fuel, but they put a cap on it or soften the curve at the top. So if oil goes too high, LNG doesn't ride all the way up with it. You know, we put a band on it. So, and I think the days of $17 and $18 LNG, or most people seem to believe those are not there, that doesn't cost that much to produce and move the gas, but it's not going to be single digits, somewhere in the middle. But I think Alaska could compete, but I don't know exactly how they're going to price in the future. That's one of the great unknowns. And you have so many suppliers, and the buyers are playing each other, suppliers off against each other and trying to get the best deal. One last thing, they're also looking for a diversified portfolio. They don't want too much from one supplier, just like you don't want to put too much of your savings in one stock. And maybe they don't want just one pricing formula, some to oil, some to U.S. prices, some to a blend. So depending where there's trouble in the world, all of their gas doesn't go up in unison. They have a blend so they can make it through some of the volatile times.
There's some discussion in reference to what's going to happen with the price of oil as gas starts coming on, more gas comes on the market and become competitive. And some people say that it'll drive the price of oil down because of the competitiveness. Do you see anything in that nature?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, there are a lot of analysts who believe oil could go $80, $90 a barrel. But even at that, on a BTU basis, under current pricing formula, you're still going to get a substantial price for LNG. You'd still be at $12, $13 if you were doing it under today's formula. And I think that's still in the ballpark.
One final question. And you said that the cost of liquefaction is the high cost. And so pipe coming down from the North Slope to Tidewater and the Kenai area gives opportunity for the rest of the state to have offshoots and taking gas that's not liquefied, therefore should be competitive within the energy market, I would think. And then is that how you would see it?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, that's the way I'd look at it, too, because you're piggybacking on this big project and pulling off a few percent for your own in-state needs. You have the economies of scale of the pipeline, but you're right, Alaskans shouldn't have to pay for the liquefaction. Their gas won't be going through it unless you're liquefying small loads to put into barges for coastal communities or something, but certainly the economies of scale of a big line with those offtakes should give Alaskans a very good opportunity for gas they can afford. You're still going to have the substantial costs of moving from that offtake into the communities, the spur lines and the local distribution lines, certainly something Fairbanks has looked at, but it's still your best bet to get gas to the doorstep.
One final question. Do you think that the amount of work that's going to be done in pre-feed area gives us a sense at that point in time of what the price would actually be coming into out of the liquefaction plant, or is it going to take longer than that?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, I don't think pre-feed gets you down to the penny. I think pre-feed will identify any big hurdles that people haven't seen yet. It'll help narrow it down, but it won't. I don't think at the end of pre-feed you would have enough to go sign the final down to the penny 25-year contracts, but certainly it'll give you a lot more information than you have now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Larry, for coming. In all the prior gas line discussions we've had, one of the things that's really intrigued me and why I'm a big supporter of a big gas line if we can get it right is that first we have the amount that's available on the North Slope that we know about, and that's what's going to fund this early version of the gas line. But the biggest dream that people have talked about, it used to be a 4.5 BCF gas line, now it's going to export something like 2.8 or something like that, was you start out with one that benefits Alaskans with affordable gas, that gets us export money like this one would, and that's good. But the broader aspiration would be in the long term, you have independents who are able to find more gas, and when they find more gas, it may be mixed in with oil fields, and both may become economic, and that's how we find more oil on the North Slope. And then with more gas, the price hopefully becomes cheaper. But that all is contingent on these independents being able to get their gas that they find, maybe an extra 1 or 2 BCF, into this pipeline, which means it would have to be expanded. And the last iteration of the gas line said you do that through rolled-in rates. And there are other ways to do it, I suppose. What can we do in this gas line deal to increase the chances that maybe that would allow independents to find that extra 1 or 2 BCF and then secure contracts, for the benefit of maybe lower price in-state gas, but B, for the benefit of finding more oil, more gas on the North Slope, and then more revenue by exporting. What can we do to so that they can effectively get their gas into a pipeline? And if you could talk about what rolled-in rates are and what that was.
Sure.
For folks who weren't around for that discussion.
Through the chair, Representative Garib, I guess several things. One, in terms of the number of an independent finding gas and having 1 to 2 billion cubic feet a day to put down the pipe, that's a lot of gas. That's a tremendous volume. I mean, that's more than you're going to get out of 2 billion cubic feet. It would be more than you get out of Prudhoe or Point Thompson for this project. More than likely, if another company is able to find an oil and gas field, just like Prudhoe, they're going to produce the oil first for years and keep the gas to pressurize it, and then at some point they'll want to start shipping gas down the line. If it's a huge field, you're talking in the hundreds of millions of cubic feet a day, not billions. The known or the proven reserves at Prudhoe and Point Thompson are not going to keep this project full forever. I don't know exactly, but I would guess sometime in the second decade you'd start to see a declining production. This is going to need more fines. This $45 to $65 billion project doesn't have enough proven reserves to last 40 or 50 years, so there's a bet the companies are taking that they or others will find trillions of cubic feet of additional gas because they need that additional gas to keep this full for 40 or 50 years. Going back to my days at Revenue, and certainly this was a contentious argument we had between Revenue and DNR, I think we can get too hung up on how we're going to expand the line to the risk of not getting the damn line. That expansion's good, and if someone finds gas, there'll be a way to when they're done producing oil, they want to move gas, or the existing fields are declining, and you have room. But if we get so hung up on ensuring that there'll be adequate capacity for unknown volumes, unknown future, it could be to our detriment. It's not a criticism, it's just an observation. In terms of rolled-in tariffs, the notion was if you have more gas and the owner of that gas wants to get it to market and there's not room that time in the pipe and they don't want to wait till later and you have to expand the pipe, who pays for that expansion? And under rolled-in, this is under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, AGIA, if the cost of that expansion raised the tariffs for everyone, including existing shippers, then everyone had to pay more. So it was rolled in, and if I've been shipping down the line at X rate for 10 years and it costs money to expand it, I'm going to have to pay more. I'm going to have to pay a share of that expansion. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think anybody is going to sign a contract or use a project where they don't know that for the term of their sales, that their tariffs may go up because someone else wants to get a room at the hotel. I just don't think in the industry that's going to happen. So under the agreement before you, the state, TransCanada, as its pipeline partner, can expand their portion of the project at any time. The new customers would have to pay for that expansion. I guess one question, and I just haven't asked it of the state team or the companies, but I'm curious, how much could you expand the pipeline by adding compressor stations, which are relatively affordable compared to new pipe? If you could add a lot of capacity just by adding compressor stations as opposed to laying new pipe, I don't think there's a problem. I really don't.
Through the chair. Thank you. And I was ultimately going to get to that. So, in the world of allowing new producers to get their gas into a gas pipeline, one is to let them pay to expand the pipeline, and that's either through rolled-in rates where everybody shares, or they just pay the extra cost. And if they're going to pay the cost, compression seems to be the cheapest way. I guess, would you agree that and I'm hoping that we can come up with something on compression because that seems to be the most sensible way to do it. But if there's not enough compression expansion capacity and we don't have rolled-in rates so that the new producer has to pay the full cost of expansion of the pipeline, does that pose a problem for the new producer to ever get their gas into the pipeline?
The chair, Representative Garam, I guess if the cost of that expansion is more than they want to pay or the market would bear, yes, that would be a problem. It's just hard to plan for unknowns. I guess, as you look ahead for the information you want between now and next year when you're brought back a final deal, it seems to me that's a good question. How much, if any, but how much could the pipeline, as it's being designed, be expanded by compressor stations, and how much might they cost? So you have some information that, we can, for roughly this amount, we can expand it by this amount, and this is how much would be for the tariff, to know whether you're in a competitive range. And that may answer the question.
Just a different question, Mr. Chair, finally.
Yes, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. And we'll get into this more during the discussion. One of the more contentious parts of this deal is that there's a proposal that the state take its gas in kind. And so you had talked about state proportional ownership of the pipeline. And, pipelines are sort of magic money. That's attractive. What are the benefits and detriments of the state taking its gas in kind as opposed to in value?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, in value, you trust the companies to sell it for the highest price possible and give you your fair return. In kind, as I understand the state's proposal, they would contract with someone to market the gas for you. So I guess the risk is that you don't strike a good marketing deal. But then, assuming you have a good marketing contract, then the risk you have is the same as everyone else in the market. And that's with LNG because of the need for the long-term cash flow to cover your mortgage, you sign long-term deals up front. With any long-term sales, it's possible it may look good at the time, and then halfway into it, something happens in the world, and some people are getting a better price for their LNG than you were when you signed your deal 10 years ago. There's a lot of countries. Yemen is in that category right now. There's a project in Australia and Indonesia. There's a couple there that are selling LNG at $4 because that's the price they sold, signed 4 years ago. In hindsight, well, maybe they should have negotiated something different. They will certainly take care of that with contract reopeners and new contracts, but I guess the risk is getting a good marketing deal and hoping it covers you within some range of how the market moves.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have Representative Guttenberg, Thompson, and Munoz, and we'll probably round it up there because we're going to stop around 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 17, you talk about big steps for Alaska. Our relationship, when we become a partner, we go from a tax collector to a partner. What do we lose when we give up our sovereignty, when we become a partner?
Through the chair, Representative, I've heard people refer to losing sovereignty, and I haven't quite figured out in my mind what exactly that means.
It might be a political term, but I'm not sure.
There would never be political terms in this. No, I'm serious. I'm not sure, because we still are a sovereign. We still have, you haven't given up rights to enforce environmental laws or wage and safety or wage and hour.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about setting up a separate corporation to deal with the marketing side and that side of it. So how would that division have to work in order to, for your impression, for the state to be successful having both roles?
Through the chair, I guess thinking back to the report we did in 2002 where we discussed, let's say if the state's a part owner in the venture and you have Fish and Game and or DEC or Labor, someone says, you need to do this on the project, whether it's some mitigation measure, construction measure, some application of wage and hour laws, and project owners say, well, that's going to drive up costs. Now you're in a conflict because you're the owner, so you don't really want to drive up your own costs, but you do have that responsibility as government to enforce the laws. I'm not sure, and by having someone in the middle, such as Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, at least they are the owner rather than your Commerce Commissioner, for example, running it as a division. I think there just has to be thoughtful discussion about potential so you have something on the record where everyone realizes these are the issues that we could be creating and how we will deal with them rather than have them come up, and we talked about this in 2002, rather than have them come up and say, well, we never thought about that. Now what do we do? So is it perfect? No. I mean, there could be some situations where you have two people, both on the third floor, making separate arguments, but this may also be the best way to get a project built. So just going in with your eyes open, knowing what you could encounter in the future.
Mr. Chair. So isn't that part of what the Norway model is, that they set up an independent corporation and they run it that way? What roadblocks and hurdles did they overcome? Obviously successfully.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, you're right. Norway has a state-owned company that holds leases and makes investments. Different political situation in Norway. I've been there a few times, asked for asylum once. They rejected it. I told them, but I like government here. They are much more disciplined. You know, it's a parliamentary form of government, so once the majority's in, the minority doesn't stop anything. Not to accuse the minority of being a blockage, it's a different form of government, and the public gets back to the patience and just this sort of stoic virtue of behaving, and they don't mess with it. It's worked well for them.
That's a nation, not a state negotiating as well, correct?
Yeah.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, we're going to be a part owner in this, theoretically, about a 25% ownership interest in this pipeline. That gives us a voice, but a minority voice. how does that work, or how doesn't that work? How does, I mean, I know I'm asking you to look inside or be inside the corporate boardroom of a conglomerate of interests, and how do the minority voices actually succeed in getting their point across, or what do they, by a vote on the board, are required to do things that are not in their best interests?
Through the chair of Representative Guttenberg, I think it's like House Finance. You make the strength of your argument convinces the others that you're right.
Is that how it works?
I think I read that in civics. Yes, you may still lose votes in seriousness because you're the minority. And if you make a motion, if you have a point, but at least you're making the argument there. And there is some value to that, even if you do lose some of the motions. But you're right. I think you're not going to win them all. One last thing on Norway. I think another reason it works so well is the public's generally happy because of the way the country is structured with taxes, very high tax. You know, personal income tax goes up to 50%. The value-added tax, which is kind of a accelerated sales tax, goes up to 25%. But your health care is taken care of, pension, education through college, so the populace is generally satisfied with the way it's run. But get back to your question. Right, you're going to be a minority, you're going to lose some votes.
One last question. Early on you said one major source of gas to China was pipeline. Now, what is the source of that gas? Where is it coming from?
It comes from, most of it, through the chair of Representative Guttenberg, from Turkmenistan. And Uzbekistan starts feeding in the last couple of years. And Myanmar, formerly Burma, opened up a pipeline into China last year. So from those three countries. But as I said, that pipeline gas to the Canadian border is priced somewhere around $10 to $12. And I was looking, the average price paid for LNG imported into China last year was $11.80, pretty similar to pipeline gas.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, just one more question. The Canadian proposal, it's First Nations or whoever it is, to bring a railroad to bring their gas up to Delta to hook into our line. Is there any movement on that? Is that a real project?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think the proposal is to bring oil up.
Right.
Oil sands production from Alberta. Through the chair, Representative, not to disparage the Canadians. I'd ask for asylum there, too, if I could get it. I don't see that as economic. It's expensive. You look at a map from Alberta to Delta is a long, long train ride, and it's a long way back with empty cars.
Thank you.
You'd have to master that language in the East. Representative Thompson and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, recently there's been a couple of consultant reports, one from Roger Marks and the other one from Rick Harper, that state that this proposal will result in a radical departure from the state's historical position and role as a sovereign, as a royalty owner, as a taxation authority, and as a regulator, which to them raises a number of issues and presents substantial risks. The state will become a direct competitor with the producers, in all aspects, transportation, shipping, marketing of this gas. And as a minority owner, the state will not have the control that it does today through existing laws and regulations. The state will have a minority stake in every regard, including gas ownership, pipeline ownership, shipping rights, etc., and will be substantially denied the leverage that it has currently. Can you comment on this and talk about the risk-reward that we're facing with this and your thoughts on the risk that we're taking?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Thompson. You know, I grew up in the 60s. I'm not sure I'd call this radical. Unusual. Yeah, it's through the chair, it's unusual. I'm not aware of any other state in the nation that has taken or is considering such a huge stake in a private venture. Sure, there's port authorities and airport authorities and toll roads, but that running airports and running highways and running ferries are more, you know, within the realm of what we think of as a public service rather than owning it. So yes, it is unusual. It's unique. It's a business, so there are risks entailed in that. I don't see where the state is giving up any statutory or regulatory authority to enforce other laws. As we talked earlier, and I've read the heads of agreement, I've read the memorandum of understanding of the legislation, I don't see anything there that says environmental, wage and hour, health and safety, zoning. I don't see anything that overrides them. But yes, there are risks. Yes, it's a departure from the norm. Yes, we'd be competing with our partners to sell oil and, well, sell liquefied natural gas overseas, though we may be contracting with them, if I understand correctly. I guess my answer to all that is I haven't seen a better plan, and it seems to me that's what the legislature and the public has before them in the next year and a half, is to talk through those issues with the administration, with the companies, with other consultants, to make sure that, yes, this is a highly unusual, unique, deviating from the norm, everything but radical step for the state, understand it fully and all the risks, and then make a decision. Is this the best way to get this project built, and what are the benefits? Do the benefits long-term outweigh the risks?
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the presentation. It's very interesting. Could you tell me what the effect of oil tax policy and the possibility of changes in our tax policy might have on the prospects, development prospects of a gas line?
Sure. Through the chair of Representative Munoz, without getting involved in SB 21 or the referendum, certainly it's all the same pocket to ExxonMobil, BP, and Conoco. And if they see an unkind tax environment on oil and the cash flow from that, which they would help, which would help pay for this, that would color their outlook on an LNG investment. As to how much and how permanently, I don't know. I really don't. But I'm sure they are following it closely.
Thank you.
It's probably the same as any human's reaction to tax policy, whether you're a homeowner, a business person, or anything. It colors it. Just the amount, we have to figure out the amount that it colors it. Well, I appreciate this the opportunity of catching while you were in town, Mr. Percy. Thank you for making your time available to the committee, as we'll probably be getting this subject matter before us within a short while. I'd say less than 35 days.
Now, that is not a risky bet, Mr. Chairman. And if I can help again, just let me know. I'm in Alaska most of the time.
Well, with that, thank you. We will be back this afternoon to take on another subject matter, and that's the omnibus education bill. It's our intent to have a presentation of by the sponsor, and we're inviting the chair of the task force on education and the education committee to join in the presentation to bring in the legislative perspective where we have to this point. And you're welcome to join us.
I could testify in pre-K, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. With that, sincere thanks from the committee, and thank you for members for the good questions. With that, we are adjourned. House Finance, come to order. It's 1:33 p.m. on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, and it is the daytime, unlike this morning, and it's
daytime.
And it's still 2014. We have just one bill, but it is a whale of a bill, the omnibus bill. Jay, if you're the omnibus bill, it's for the listening public, uninitiated in matters legislative. It's one bill that contains many
items and subject matters, hopefully of the same, under our uniform rules, of the same connectivity. Before we start, we'd like to note that we have a quorum. We have Vice Chair Newman, we have Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, Representative T. Wilson, Co-Chair Osterman Stoltz, Representative Costello, Representative Guerra, and Representative Holmes. It is it's our intent to just today have a presentation of the bill, and very graciously the education chairperson, who also chaired the sustainability task force, who pulled together many provisions, of some of which we've heard in this committee already, into this bill, and let us give us the roadmap, and then we'll have the administration come up after that. I don't know what your timeline is, Representative Gaddis.
I'm here as long as you need me. That being said, okay, clearly I haven't been here. Representative Gaddis, and I represent the greater Wasilla, and thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members, for letting
before
me.
Before we start, well, just as an administrative matter, so we have a bill before us. So.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 278, Education Version November, before the committee as a working draft.
Without objection, that will remain the draft until we change it.
Chair, there's one other administrative matter.
Yes, sir.
I haven't forgotten that I owe donuts. I just haven't gotten around to it.
Okay.
We're going to have some. You're not getting green ones today. You'll get normal colored ones.
We will make sure that that's attended to, and I wish I ate donuts. Thank you, Representative Guerra. That's definitely for the good of the order.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. House Bill 278, Version N, I think the co-chair said it correctly. It was a whale of a bill. We looked at hearing this bill in its entirety, and it became quite clear that we needed to break it out in chunks. So we found 10, at least 10 different components in this bill, and I'll speak to them very briefly. The committee also dealt with 24 amendments, and the result of those are in front of you as House Bill 278, Version N. And I'll begin with the Section 1, the high school course credit earned through assessment. The governor's bill provided for testing out for students who could prove mastery of a subject through an assessment rather than having to do required seat time in classroom, and thereby a student can receive credit for that course if the established mastery or proficiency rate on the assessment is reached. The House Education Committee amended the bill with language similar to HB 190, which provides for the development of more course assessments to be made available to students and other than just the courses that are required courses for meeting the criteria for the Alaska Performance Scholarship Program. Sections 2, 3, and 4 of the bill. These sections deal with eliminating the requirement for passing the HSGQE, and I admit that I had a struggle with that. It's a high school graduating qualifying exam. Certainly we shorten it to HSGQE. The committee
We're not going to put capital punishment, then it would be the final exit exam.
And the committee amended out of any requirement for the state to pay for a student to take a post-secondary test such as ACT, SAT, or work keys. The current requirement from the State Board of Education for high school juniors to take the work keys is not impacted by this potential change. So that essentially means that the House had taken the option for parents to choose work keys, ACT or SAT. We took the ACT and SAT out. Work keys is still in. And the committee amended the requirement for determining and reporting on the number, the attendance rates, and the performance of students whose parents are active duty military. The effective date for the transition regarding these sections were amended to June 30th, 2017, from June 30th, 2017 to June 30th, 2015. Sections 5 begins a section with deal with charter school applications, and I'll say that we spent a lot of time with charter schools. That was probably the biggest portion of this bill as far as time spent. deals with charter applications, appeals, and programs. The first segment regarding charter schools was amended to add language allowing the State Board of Education to be an alternative authorizer of a charter school. Though the bill's initial language states that a denial from a local district for a charter school application could be appealed to the commissioner, then could be approved by the commissioner, the committee amended that portion to state that the State Board of Education could become the charter school's chartering and operating authority, so a charter school would not have to try to operate within a hostile environment of a district that it initially denied it. The amendment, however, does provide for giving the local district a chance to appeal and request that it become the operating authority. This section also amended by the committee to limit the length of time by which a local board had to make its decision to approve or deny to 60 days. If you move on to Section 8, you'll see where the committee amended that section to add that a charter has the right of first refusal for leasing of available space of school district facilities, and that the district can charge a reasonable fee that reflects the true operational costs of that facility. Section 9 limits the amount that a district can charge in indirect cost fees to 4%. Skipping into Section 12, it was amended by the committee to require that school districts formulate policies and thoughtfully address the transportation challenges of their charter school districts. Districts would be charged with coordinating transportation routes and transportation availability as best as they can within their current transportation plan in order to provide transportation where and when feasible. If not, the districts will have to forfeit the portion of their transportation funds generated by the number of students attending the charter school and hand that money over to the charter school. And I'll have to say that that was one of my amendments, and it passed unanimously once it was realized that we're not trying to change the transportation system that the schools already operate in, but the goal and the intent, if the school bus drives by with seats open, please stop, pick up our kids, and as it continues driving, if it drives by the charter school, stop and open up the door and let our kids out.
It was so, easier once folks understood that charter schools weren't private schools.
That, right? There you go. Okay. And in fairness, that was part of the long conversation. As we have charter schools that may have been put in as experimental, at least in this state, and processed through as pilot-type programs, now that they've become really part of our institutional and how we operate, I think there were a lot of folks that didn't quite understand how a charter school is funded, where they have to pay, where the inequities are, and I'll have to say, speak to the governor's portion of the bill. I think that the governor saw that, and that we have come of age, and the charter schools truly are an opportunity to compete on a local level and offer parents certainly a choice.
And complement.
Yeah. And complement what we already have. And you can tell that by the long lines of folks trying to get into these charter schools. So, again, we spend a lot of time talking about it. It does not require the district to specifically provide transportation for students, but they do not. But they do have to allow charter school students to take advantage of normal bus routes whenever reasonably possible. In Section 18, the end of that section was amended to allow for bonding by municipality or borough for construction additions and major rehabilitation projects for charter schools. That will allow for a 70% debt reimbursement of bonds for charter schools. Though it seems a little out of order, Section 17 was added in to decrease the minimum number of students required for establishing the funding rate for a charter school within its first 3 years and allowing the adjusted student count to be counted at the same rate as for 150 students. Looking back at sections 15 and 16, the governor's bill provided for an improved application process for creating new residential schools and for an increase in the stipend to more accurately reflect the actual audited costs of boarding school students, and the House Education Committee simply amended Section 37 to provide for an effective date of July 1st, 2014, replacing the governor's date of September 1st. And that really was just a housekeeping aspect. You need to know by July 1st. Once September 1st has happened, you've already started school. So I think the administration confirmed that that was just a housekeeping. Sections 18, 19, and 20 deal with the base student allocation increases. The committee did not address this component of the bill that deals with the BSA, but decided from the beginning that it was an issue better discussed in House Finance. So the committee passed that portion unamended. Section 21, Technical and Vocational Education Programs, TVEP. The percentages for the funding allocation were amended in order to add another program to the list of supported programs. The University of Alaska percentage was decreased to 42%, and the Southern Southeast Alaska Technical Education Center was added at 3%. Section 22 is amended.
That, much like the BSA, that will be up to discussion, that particular section. I think the process has started.
That's right, and thank you. Section 22 was amended to add more reporting requirements to verify the performance results of these programs. Moving on to Section 25 and the tax credit component of the governor's bill, this section further defines the items that can be identified as costs and added a tax credit for contributions made to early learning and childhood development programs to include those provided by for a for-profit corporation. This section was also amended to clarify that this tax credit applies to those contributing to post-secondary schools or institutions within the state, not outside the state. That language is repeated again in sections 26, 28, 29, 31, 32, 34, and 35. Section 37 repeals Section 3. CH 91 SLA 2010, which will remove the sunset date to allow Alaska to continue to seek federal grants for providing startup funds for new charter schools. We heard in testimony that we hadn't received any federal money, but we wanted to keep the door open in case it was going to come through. Folks in the committee couldn't see a downside to that. The amendments made by the House Education Committee make our charter school environment even stronger in the state of Alaska. They further reduce unnecessary testing requirements in our state and the costs associated with testing and improve incentives for corporations and organizations to support our vocational opportunities and the learning opportunities of our youngest students. The amendments will more effectively support the governor's efforts to improve our education system in our state.
Back to the other report, Section 38, was that similar to the charter schools?
I'm sorry, say again?
You talked about Section 37, the charter school sunset repealer. What was 38? I'm going to look it up later if you don't tell me.
I am, as far as the sunset, I don't know.
There's two repealers in there.
Yeah, I think...
We're going to have the bill for a while.
I think there was a sunset on TVEP, too. I'm not exactly sure what 38 was.
Okay. The repealers are often more powerful than the other more descriptive parts of language. Oh, I appreciate you walking this through. You're certainly welcome to stay with us. I think the three commissioners will now try to outdo you, but I'm not sure they're going to be able to.
Thank you, committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Osterman.
Yeah.
Representative Gaddis.
Could we get your comments in writing?
I mean, yes, you can.
Yeah, thank you.
I thought you had that all memorized. Commissioners, round two. You're kind of like Elizabeth Taylor's seventh husband here. You generally know what you're supposed to do, but you got to try to make it interesting after that, right?
I got nothing to that.
I'm going to calm down. I'm sorry.
Not positive her seventh husband was able, but...
didn't know she had seven.
That's for sure.
We do have seven fiscal notes.
So. Welcome, commissioners. Welcome, commissioners. And I'm calling things to order. I can't believe it.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Hannon, the commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
For the record, I'm Angela Rodell, commissioner for the Department of Revenue.
And I'm Diane Bloomer, commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Chair Stoltz, I can surely begin simply by clarifying the repeal of Section 38. That's the only place that the HSGQE is actually repealed. It's not specifically named, but that section is the HSGQE. So that's the repeal of that exam.
Thank you. For show, sir. And defer to your colleagues as you wish.
I'll simply go through and address a couple of things that that differ from the governor's bill. The initial bill that put forward is the comprehensive bill.
And as you're going through, feel free, as you are the representing the sponsor of the bill, you can make your subjective and objective remarks about what the changes made, whether they were improvements or detriments, and things. What's your legitimate aspirations were for this bill that may not have been included.
Thank you, Chair Stoltz.
Or illegitimate, I'm not sure.
I won't touch on all of them because some of them clarified and just brought a different perspective to the governor's intent, although it didn't change the governor's intent. But there are a couple of components that I'd like to address.
Commissioner, and I didn't mean to interrupt again, but just to help guide you, please, as you're presenting this to 11 new people here other than the members who run the Sustainability Task Force, please outline the governor's goals and objectives and hopes and tying together the elements of the bill.
Great. Thank you. And I can begin with that and touch on those components as I go through. Ultimately, the governor had a vision of reforming education largely by looking at the things we currently do, cleaning up those things, removing barriers to allow us to improve education, and incorporating the an increase in the BSA to those reform conversations. The first component in regards to the secondary school course credit where students are allowed to test out, the difference, the House Education Committee aligned this bill with HB 190, which was begun last year. The difference between the two, and it was simply a difference that I asked when having conversations with the governor, it allows students to test out and requires school districts to provide the opportunity for students to test out. We identified specific courses, reading, writing, math, social studies, science, and world languages. And we did that to recognize, one, the burden that it is on districts to develop these assessments, but also to recognize that some courses are experiential in nature and don't naturally lend themselves to an end-of-course exam. And I think of courses like drama, or pottery, or debate. Those types of courses are experiential in nature, and we chose to focus on naming those, not courses, but topics, those subjects, as opposed to requiring districts to come up with a debate final or a debate test that students could test out in. So that is the primary difference between what is before you as a CS and the governor's bill. Chair Gaddis spoke correctly in regards to the ACT and SAT. With the removal of the HSGQE, the idea was to remove a high-stakes exam that a student must pass and to provide a choice of exams, assessments, that a student could use towards their next step after high school. Currently, WorkKeys is required in 11th grade. The idea here was to simply allow them a choice. If a student knew that they were going to college, and they needed an SAT or ACT score, they had the option of not taking the WorkKeys, but taking the SAT or ACT. We thought that that was an important option for students to use. Currently, in the draft before you, the WorkKeys is still required, as Representative Gaddis spoke, but not the option to take the SAT or ACT.
And before you get too far, Commissioner, there's one other mental note I left on the table, and that was I've had a lot of input on the issue of Common Core. And if you could describe whether or not what the administration's position is on that and what elements of Common Core may be present in this bill, whether it's directly indirectly or even subliminally. And I don't mean that in a trite.
No,
manner.
I understand.
No, it's a as you are keenly aware, that is a large issue for a large section
Absolutely.
Of the public. So, and I'm sorry, I promise not to try not to interrupt you again.
No, that's fine. I appreciate it, Chair Stoltz.
I meant it that.
The Common Core is a set of academic standards that were developed, and a lot of states around the country have adopted, recognizing that too many of our kids, meaning around the country, United States kids, are not adequately prepared when they leave high school. But they're academic standards. Alaska referenced the Common Core. We have standards that are very similar, so our kids will be competitive with what they learn here in Alaska. But there is no connect. There are no components of the standards in here. So this really truly is something that's totally separate from the Common Core. Alaska adopted new academic standards for our kids in June of 2012. So we've been on board for and implementing those for about the last year and a half, going on 2 years. And even subliminally, there's really no connection between these policies before you in this bill and those academic standards. One component in regards to the residential schools that wasn't spoken about, the largest thing that has gotten attention is the increase in the boarding stipend to recognize the true cost, but also it requires the department to open up a period of open application period annually. I opened one up a year ago, and we have some great new schools on board now. It doesn't require the commissioner to approve, but it does require that opportunity for districts to submit an application during an open application period. One place I do find relatively problematic, potentially problematic, I'll say, is that recognizing the challenge of starting new charter schools, the governor's vision was to remove some of the barriers to doing so. And the key component to the charter school application, it requires an academic policy committee, which is made up of parents, to go to their local school board and apply to start a charter school. The first part of the comprehensive bill in regards to that is to say that the response from that local school board needs to be in writing based on fact and conclusions of law. So it brings some integrity to the local process. That, I think, is the key component. It does allow then, if they're denied at that local level, after that process has gone through, to appeal that to the commissioner. The commissioner then has the potential to remand it back for further consideration, to confirm that denial, or to suggest an approval. And ultimately, it still goes to the state board as it does now. For the state board, and one of the amendments to this from the House Education Committee, for the state board to become the new authorizers if they were to overturn the local school district, is that essentially they start a new school district. And the fiscal note on this is indeterminate, because we're not sure how many denials will come or could come and be overturned. But potentially what you do is you take a school, a new charter school, and it would become like a Mount Edgecombe. It would become its own school district. We would hire a new superintendent to run that. We would also hire new state or new teachers, and they would all be state employees. So there's a significant fiscal note for the state to start a new school in that regard. So the idea of having a multiple authorizer that is the State Board of Education does have some unintended consequences that bring a significant fiscal note to the state to do that.
We're going to go through the...
The only other part that I will point out at this time is the tax credits that are that were included. There was an amendment to add a tax credit for early education that was referenced. The governor also added two additional tax credits. One was to defray the costs of students who are taking dual credits, you know, course fees, registration fees, also allows for transportation or potentially room and board for acquiring those dual credits. And that's largely when we look at programs like ANSEP or RAHI, the Rural Alaska Honors Institute, where they bring students in the summer and help them get their college and high school credits. There's a tax credit to recognize that. The other one that the governor added was to help provide funding for maintenance, operation, or construction of a dorm facility, a residential facility for one of the approved residential schools. That's not currently able to be funded through our CIP or major maintenance process. This would allow a tax credit for that. Chair Stoltz, I'll stop and surely entertain questions and can expound on other components if you
want. Why don't we have all the commissioners go through and that way we get through this. And our round of questions will probably take a long time. And why don't we, we're on tax credits, why don't we go to you, Commissioner? That's probably your main provision here, isn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner of Revenue, I mean, there's three commissioners.
For the record, Angela Rodell, Commissioner of Revenue, and I'm just going to touch briefly on what Commissioner Hanley said about the tax credit. It's important to note that the overall education tax credit cap of $5 million per taxpayer was not increased or changed in any way. There were just additional uses added to what would qualify for the education tax credit. And the important piece for the tax credits is really to encourage private investment into our education system and to create those opportunities for partnership with the private sector. So I think that the additions that were made, the amendments that were made, whether it was to fund scholarships for dual credit, for construction of residential facilities or childhood education, all of these expansions of the education tax credit are important to expanding opportunities for students across the state of Alaska, and importantly, don't expand the overall tax credit and increase the amount beyond the $5 million cap for an education tax credit claim. And with that, I'll answer any questions or turn it to Commissioner Bloomer.
We'll go to Commissioner Bloomer. I think we'll get to the questions. You only have a few sections in here as well.
Thank you. I do. I have, for the record, Diane Bloomer, Commissioner for Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And we have one section in here, which is the Technical Education VOTEC program. We call it TVEP. And it provides statewide job training funds for statewide job institutions. And the governor's main focus here was to recognize the importance of career and technical education and to provide for a bridge or a partnership with the high schools, the local high schools, or even distance high schools through that process. So identifying a requirement of an articulated agreement with the VOTEC schools and the high schools, also with the universities, and then also to add a component where the reporting requirements were a little more stringent and enforceable by the department. So with the amendments that were made in the bill before you today, the language includes performance and financial information to be provided to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development in order for you folks to be able to determine if the outcomes for the performance measures are acceptable and meeting the mark that has been laid out. I think that's about it. There was a change in the formula funding, and as you mentioned, Chair Stoltz, you will probably be talking about that. So at this point, there's only been one change made to the formula funding.
So. Do you have any, before we go into questions, you want to tie anything together, Commissioner?
There's only one other component that I'd like to address. Thank you. There was one section, and that was in regards to the bond reimbursement for charter schools. Basically, we have criteria for reimbursement at a 70-30 rate where the state picks up 70%. Largely, it's square footage restrictions. It's based on the number of students you have in your school district. You qualify for construction of so much square footage, essentially. With 60-40, you don't have those square footage requirements. This component, in effect, allows a 70-30 reimbursement of those bonds without the space requirements. So we could increase space in a school district, increase structures, and reimburse at a higher rate than we currently do. So that's the only other component that I don't think I touched on previously. Thank you.
Does that provision read that it's a 70% or up to 70%?
It would be a 70-30. This would say that they're reimbursed at a 70-30 rate, even though they only met the requirements of a 60-40.
That may be something we want to look at. We want to treat them fairly, but not more fairly. Okay. Do you have anything else before you go to the rapid? I wish it was a rapid question. It's going to be a long question round.
I'm prepared for questions.
Okay. We'll start out with Representative Guttenberg and then Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thompson. Edgman.
Dealing with the charter schools and the application to a school district and the denial and the appeal, are all of those reasons set out in statute already? I mean, reasons why they can deny? I mean, it sounded like that there, from your statement, that sometimes they don't have timely responses from the school districts they're applying for, and then now you're setting up another process where there's an appeal. Are all those reasons set out in statute? Are they delineated?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there is no appeal process currently. That part is new. Right now, if they're denied at the local level for any reason, the process basically stops. And so the idea was to provide a second set of eyes to review an application for a charter school.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So is the reasons for denying it in the first place, are those delineated? And what would be the reasons for reconsideration from to go back and reconsider it?
To the chair, Representative, right now there are no reasons at all. The denial can be for any reason. And this is based on states that it's based on fact and considerations of law, conclusions of law. So that's the extent of the details of what those decisions should be made on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Osterman and then Thompson.
excuse me. My question deals with Section 13 on the 7030. First question is the sunset. Why is it sunsetted? Is that something that was in the original bill? Is that something you did? Maybe I've got the wrong information in front of me.
Maybe we can invite Representative Gaddis up. This might be one that, is she still here? Nope. She would have been best suited to answer that probably. That wasn't something you birthed and nurtured, right?
No, but I don't believe that there's a new sunset in regards to the 7030.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
I was looking at some notes here from you on March 14th. You sent me with these years. This talks about Section 13. On page 2, Section 13, where it talks about from July the 1st through 14th through December 31st on 17.
Yes, thank you. Since this is new, that a school that only meets the 60-40 requirements and would qualify for the 70-30 reimbursement, it would be a three-year program. So there's currently not a sunset. This would simply allow it to go for 3 years. So with the new provision, it would last 3 years and then sunset, apparently.
In my mind, that's what it says. But
right. So there wasn't previously a sunset. This puts a sunset in place, and I couldn't speak to why.
Okay. I'll get that later.
Do you have any other items over here?
No.
Okay, then on to Representative Thompson. We'll get to talk about a lot of these issues a lot more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I maybe just can't seem to locate it in here, but on the reimbursement of 70%, I can't see why not have the same size and building standards required that are currently in place for public school buildings. I couldn't find where the charter school would have that same size and standards.
That wasn't a provision the department inserted. So, Representative Gaddis, would you like to join? Would you like to join us?
I would love to.
Your ears were probably burning.
Yes, of course they are. Could you re-ask the question, whatever it was?
And while you catch your breath. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was looking through here, on the 70% reimbursement, I can't see where it's tied into the to the public schools. Why not have the same size and building standards that are required currently in place for public schools? I mean, I didn't see where that they have that in there for the charter schools.
And Representative Thompson, I don't recall the conversation coming up about the same size, whether it be for the neighborhood schools, since they're both public, and the charter schools, as far as the size constraints. The bigger conversation was about charter schools having to lease their own property, pay for their own property tax, and certainly use that same funding that the neighborhood schools use, that they do not have to do that. So that's where it really came from. I have charter schools in my district that are leasing, not able to purchase, not being part of a bonding program. And so if the school district doesn't put them forward, they don't have that opportunity. So that's what this portion of the bill did, is it put them, that they can actually go to the municipality and ask for that bonding. And but I think your question was more into the size.
And the building standards that are now kind of in place for public schools, where they have R values of the walls and ceilings. I mean, this I think is, I couldn't find where it was included in the charter school part.
And again, that conversation, that portion didn't come up. I can say that I think that it was assumed, and I know one should never assume, but I think it was assumed that the same school intent should be for charter schools as well. And because we spend a lot of time talking parity and equity, that our charter school kids should have the same opportunities. Conversation about charter schools that are now in the portables that our neighborhood schools certainly could not participate in, and that now have become charter schools. So those type of conversations, and I think it was assumed, it wasn't my amendment, that that bonding opportunity, and actually I got to there's Representative Quito's amendment, who had worked with and for DEED and had brought that amendment forward, seeing that inequity. So again, I think most of us assume that that was covered in what we already do with our neighborhood schools.
That may be subject to some refinement too. If we're trying to create parity, then this amendment, as proposed, this provision might make them more equal, which isn't a bad thing if you're to catch up. But I think we're seeking to have them on the same on the same level playing field. And so that's something we can work on, that provision, Representative Thompson, and get that aligned.
Yeah. Follow up another question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain also then, and I didn't understand it, maybe it just maybe repeat it, why did we do away with the SAT, ACT, and career readiness assessment exams?
That sounds like a commissioner question, right?
It actually may not be, because the governor did have it in. But the House Education Committee did remove it.
And I can speak, it was not my amendment, but the amender felt that the college and career readiness verbiage had a lot to do with Common Core. And because that is verbiage used in the Common Core standards, that they wanted to take that out. And so in doing so, basically just remove the ACT and the SAT. Because Work Keys was falls under a different bill from a different time, it didn't get taken out, and I think the intent was to take all three of them out, but they didn't.
Okay.
So it really has to do, I think, more so with the college and career readiness verbiage, and less to do with the ACT and SAT, with the exception that they are in fact aligned with the Common Core. Did that make any sense at all?
Yes, it did.
Good.
I read a bit about the Common Core being tied.
So I think that was the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgman, and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask about just a quick question about residential school stipends and whether that's the same as boarding home school stipends. And I guess the second part of that question would be, do the stipends in this bill recognize or address the first grade through, was it eighth grade, that part of the stipend?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, residential schools and boarding schools we often use synonymously, so they're the same. Residential schools are for secondary school students only, which is high school students only, but not K-8.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Okay. And I think Representative Osterman had a question before Representative Gaddis leaves, so I don't know whether he wanted to re-ask his question first.
I'm not leaving.
Okay, she's not going to leave. Okay, well, never mind. So she's going to be there. I guess mine's more...
I guess you heard that invitation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying, you know, there's a lot of things in this bill, and the task force has gone over a lot of information this last year. And so, I don't know, this may be a governor question versus a commissioner question, but I'm just trying to figure out what... So what data was used that these were the things that we needed to do to be able to, I'm assuming, step up our game and have better graduation rates, fewer dropouts and those. So why these things were chosen versus like the one-on-one that we've been hearing about for digital learning, the $5 million that the governor has in, it's not really included in here. So because unless we know what data we're using to, with these programs, then the second question is what data are we going to use to see if what we did in this bill, because this has got a lot of money into about every one of these pieces of program, whether they're working or not.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't believe these are really focused on new programs, but focused on currently the things we're doing and sometimes artificial barriers that we have in place. So when we look at the charter schools, the idea is to remove some of those barriers and make sure that we have equity with our charter schools. With our residential schools, it is to open up a period annually to allow them to apply to be a residential school. The components that have positive fiscal notes are primarily the BSA and the increase of the boarding stipends for our residential schools. The HSGQE component has a negative fiscal note to it, and some of these don't have a fiscal note to them. So the idea is to do more introspection and look at what we're currently doing. These typically don't – I'm trying to think if we've got a new – we've got some additional tax credits to incentivize some private-public partnerships. But I think it's looking at what we're already doing and trying to improve that.
Follow-up? I didn't say we were doing anything new. I'm just trying to figure out why these programs – okay, so what data did the department use, which I'm assuming that's – maybe I shouldn't assume – data that was used to say, of all the things that are going on throughout the entire state, these are the things that are working because of this data. And so by putting more resources into or having less barriers in the way, we can expect this.
To the chair, Representative Wilson, this surely isn't comprehensive to everything that we could do. It does address some of the things that we can do relatively easily, because we've got some built-in barriers. And again, if I just were to go through those components, I think that providing greater opportunity for students when we require the ability to test out of classes, to add the SAT, ACT, if that's where a student wants to go, I think that these are all – is there data around – a student taking the work keys versus the SAT, ACT? No, but I think there's a recognition that not all students need the work keys, and that some students have a vision for college, and so the tool that they would use would be the SAT or ACT. Clear data around removing barriers may not be there, but I think it just seems to make sense.
And I'll wait till some of the parts of the bill, but here's where my concern is that, and I think it's charter schools or boarding schools or the others, but, you know, I guess when you get some sleep, you start thinking about other things. But are we taking just a few students out of our brick-and-mortar schools just enough to where they still have to have all the same infrastructure costs but less students, and therefore they need more money per student because they actually have less of them because we're only pulling out a few students versus enough to close down a school, you know? And I looked at my own, and right now with the charter schools we have in Fairbanks, you know, it gives opportunity for a few, but so far they have all the same number of schools, same bus routes, same everything, except they don't have the same number of students because of the other opportunities that we've done. And I'm not saying we shouldn't allow the opportunity. I'm just trying to figure out financially, as we create more of these opportunities, how the cost goes with it. But my biggest concern is, and we haven't on the task force figured that out, Mr. Chairman, is data. We have got to figure out when we're going to do these barriers and undoing what we're doing is, how do we know whether they're successful? As we add more boarding schools, you know, how do we know whether the boarding school is successful or not successful? Is it based on the number of students or even on the testing out? If I'm testing out an algebra class in Fairbanks, it should be the same test as Kenai, as Dillingham, as any of them, because those students are the same ones who are going to go to the university versus every district making up their own testing. So I'm not just concerned about the cost of the state on some of this, but there's a lot of cost to our districts in parts of these bills as well. We've got to make sure that we keep in. And I just want to clarify one thing. On Common Core, because we all hear it from ours, whether or not we adopt the Common Core standards, because we did adopt a lot of the Common Core standard, when we pick out a curriculum, when we do testing, especially the curriculum, because most of the states are doing Common Core, it is going to come into our schools by the curriculum that our districts pick, just because they're going to write curriculum to the majority of states and whatever standards that they have adopted. So there's been some confusion that we have to adopt the Common Core to be utilizing it, and that's not true. Our books will still contain it because most of the states have gone that direction.
Thank you.
Through the chair, I would simply say that, you know, with charter schools in particular, we're not anymore. We're allowing districts to say we've got a need here and allowing them to expand as a part of their own district. And I guess it's an opportune time to address the Common Core once again. But I took the SAT and ACT when I was in high school. The Common Core has been around for a few years now. So to somehow say that the Common Core, you know, the SAT and ACT are Common Core driven is a little bit strange to me. The addition of those into the governor's bill were just a recognition. That's the language colleges use for entrance. Had nothing to do with other standards. It's been that way. It was there when I needed a score when I got into college. So, but I do understand when we're looking at additional charter schools and opportunities for residential schools, I think it's increased opportunity, but not driven by the state, driven by the needs at the local level.
I think there's been some concern about Common Core because we've had expressed opposition from the administration and then say, well, it's in there, what's the big deal, to it's not in there. I think you've had a little bit of problem on your messaging on Common Core, and not to point any fingers about any men. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanley, do any of the provisions on this bill, a lot of things are funded in here, do any of the provisions in this bill take away any funds from the BSA that's received by school districts for non-charter schools?
Through the chair. Representative Guerra, no.
Okay, thanks. And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
One of the things we're going to discuss, and I'm just wondering if you – I remember your answer from last time, but – have you studied at all what BSA amount might be needed by school districts to avoid a fourth year of cuts next year?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, I have, and we had actually have provided that to your office. But I will tell you that no two districts have the exact same number. Right. So if I were to give you, you know, one may say 110 and one may say 150. So if I give you an average, it's erroneous. It's erroneous for the district that doesn't need that much, and it's erroneous for the district that it's not enough. There is no good number, and actually, if I had have provided a number for you at that time, it would be wrong today because those districts have changed their numbers. I will say this, that in my ongoing conversations with districts, numbers tend to be between $100 and $200, and I've had a few districts that have said in excess of $200. I haven't had any speak to me about a $400 increase. So those numbers continually have changed in ongoing conversations. So it's really impossible to give you a number that reflects every district across the state.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair.
Commissioner Guerra.
Commissioner, I didn't mean a number for the whole state. I meant what the various school districts need, and we can debate it, but if you've read the Juno Empire, they need over $400, and there are a number of school districts in that same pairing, so maybe we've spoken to different school districts. There's a provision that says for charter school denial or approval, a charter school proponent can appeal to the Commissioner of Education, but I don't see any standards for the Commissioner of Education to make a decision. It just says they may appeal, but what standards would you use? Is it a good charter school? Will it move achievement forward? All denied because it won't move achievement forward. I don't see any standards unless you have some somewhere else, or I'm missing something in the bill.
And what are the standards now that Commissioner Cuomo used to deny a bunch of them, and other superintendents have?
My question is, state is now charged with?
I'm the chair. I can addendum. That's just one of the prerogatives.
That addendum is fine. My question is, you are now charged for the first time ever with. Accepting an appeal and denying or reversing the decision. I don't see any standards in the bill. Do you have standards that exist in law now for denial or acceptance of the charter school?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there is no appeal process now, so there are no standards listed in statute or regulation as to what those would be, and they are spelled out in this bill. So the conclusions of law and the statements of fact that come from the local school district would be the same criteria that would come to the commissioner at this point. There's no additional language on what the commissioner would do to address the appeal.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the high school qualifying exam, I think probably you've got pretty good support in the building, most of us. I think it's time for it to go. The way it's written right now, I don't want to discriminate against students in the past who've completed all their coursework but haven't passed. They don't get a diploma, but those in the future do for doing the same exact work. So is the bill as it's written now, will it grant a high school diploma to those who received what was formerly called a certificate of completion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guerra, the way it's written now is that people who graduate up to this year, since this will not have passed, but up to this year, will need to have passed that HSGQE. This bill, the governor put in 3 years of transitional language to allow adults who have left with a certificate of achievement instead of a diploma to allow them to come back and pass that HSGQE to get their diploma. This bill was amended from 3 years to match up with HB 220 from Representative Higgins and to make it a one-year transition to allow that HSGQE to be given for one more year, basically two more administrations of that assessment to allow students to get their diploma.
And just for the committee's information, it's our intent to try to pass out House Bill 220. I think there's a symbolism, as it's been referred to, in repealing that. And what the other body decides to do in rolling things back in together, that's all up to all up to our best guess, but it's our intent to send that bill out if there's committee support prior to this bill leaving. No, Representative Guerra, after that.
Thank you. As you can tell from my question, I think prior students should be treated the same, but we'll work on that.
Mr. Chair,
through
the chair, Representative Guerra, if I could speak on two things before we get too further on. As far as the appeal process, there was a lot of discussion in committee, I'll go back to the appeal process for the charter schools, just to be real clear. A lot of discussion, and I think that what we had agreed on is that the commissioner certainly would have a criteria that the charter schools would know what they're supposed to be writing to. So it's not going to be something that he'll be arbitrary on each and every charter school, and we spent a lot of time on that. So I just don't know that it was necessarily real clear in the presentation here, but I think that that's what you were speaking to.
Just final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
If you go to Section 6 and 7 of the bill, that's the appeal on the charter school. Um, I just don't see any standards or any authority for the commissioner to come up with standards. So it just says the commissioner shall approve or deny, but doesn't say under what guidelines, whether the charter school wasn't good enough, whether it was. It says nothing about that. So
that's part of the committee process. We'll work on that if we need to refine that.
There's no objection from the governor's office or from the administration in clarifying what that looks like, because we have to look beyond my tenure as commissioner and what it would look like for the next commissioner, and it can be done in regulation or it can be done in statute.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Well, staff has got that as a notation. Thank you. Representative Costello and then Co-Chair Osterman and then Representative Newman.
Thank you, through the Co-Chair. My question has to do with the transportation element in the bill. And specifically in regards to how lottery schools are addressed, because we have the Russian immersion, the Spanish immersion, the Japanese immersion in Anchorage, the Denali Montessori. These are lottery schools that are housed in neighborhood schools. And so you have the BSA right now and the transportation funding going to the school, but you have parents that are driving from across town. So with how are lottery schools addressed in the bill?
I think we can probably do a joint answer to this. I'll begin through the chair, Representative Costello. The governor originally, the current language in statute says that charter schools shall have a budget that reflects no less than the amount generated by those students in the same manner as other schools in the school district. The idea is equity. So a student basically generates the BSA. But the language that the governor put in said it also includes the funding component, the formula component that is the special ed block component, the vocational technical education component, and the governor put in the transportation funding. It's a different formula, but it is still generated by per student. And the idea behind that was equity, not how it's done, but that a student, just because they go to a charter school, should have some access. They're generating funds. They should have some access to transportation. It doesn't mean necessarily that they would go to every one of their homes around the district and bring them in, but it could mean that they have drop-off spots, or there should be a conversation about transportation. I appreciate what the Education Committee did. They removed the language and clarified it further on, as Representative Gaddis spoke to, that it should be a part of that conversation about providing transportation at least to a minimal extent. And the idea is equity, and I'll surely allow Representative Gaddis to speak to the final language there.
Yeah, Representative Gaddis here. And I guess the final language was there were charter schools, and they were having a tough time speaking to their school district. And when they said, hey, you've got a bus going right by some of our kids, not all of our kids, but some. And if there are empty seats, can't you pick them up? And they could not and did not have a conversation with their school district. So what this did is it essentially forces the school district to really have that conversation. And if they refuse I apologize not knowing what a lottery school is. I'm assuming that, is that a charter school?
It is not.
Okay. It's a neighborhood school that already has busing there, or it's an optional school that you can, like a boundary exemption school. Is that what?
Are you recognizing me or someone else? Yeah. Thank you. Through the chair. So the lottery
forced busing, though.
Program is a program in which the parents lottery into the school, but it's a public school that houses an additional program. For example, the Spanish immersion at one of the schools, and the Japanese immersion and the Russian immersion and the Denali Montessori. So you have a blend of a neighborhood school that has busing for the neighborhood students, and then you have the families that have lotteried in that essentially are outside of the district, and so they're driving in. So in terms of the challenge, it's no different than the charter school. And my other question too about the transportation, and I apparently lottery schools was not a part of the conversation in the Education Committee.
And the word never came up. I know in the Mat-Su we call them mission schools, but they are the same thing. Where if you're out,
religious.
No.
I just want to make that clear.
But you're absolutely right. They have the same concern, and it just didn't come up. I don't think we thought about it. We got so wrapped up in regards to charter schools, and we had the charter schools calling in and testifying that quite frankly. I think that had it come up, I think we would have put lottery schools or mission schools or boundary-exempt kids. If you're boundary-exempt but a school bus goes right by and you can pick up and you can still drop off and there's an extra seat, I mean, those kids should also have that opportunity to ride on a school bus in which their parents also have paid taxes within that community. So the discussion didn't come up.
Was there any discussion about exempting charter schools from paying property taxes if they're leasing their facility?
The chair, no, there wasn't, because the idea of the local property taxes is a local decision.
And that's all I have right now, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Osterman and then Newman.
Thank you. The question that I asked her was in reference to Section 13 on the 70-30 split and the what I call sunsetting that in 2017. What discussion was around in your committee in reference to that, to sunsetting that date? I mean, it could, if I understand it correctly, just reading this, is that on December 31st, 2017, it goes back, charter schools go to a 60-40 like everybody else.
I'm not sure. I don't think the dates were not discussed. I think more of the discussion was the 70-30 for a charter school, more so than the dates, and they got wrapped up in regards to the funding for the charter schools and less about the dates. And the dates were something that somebody who may have worked for Deed is specifically in the building type department, and they may have known more than we did at that time. So I don't know the answer, but that conversation never came up.
Okay, on the same subject, I think, Commissioner, the 60-40, charter schools currently have a 60-40, and then can they qualify for 70-30?
Through the chair, any school district school, which a charter school is, can qualify for 70-30 or 60-40 based on the square footage requirements of the district. Typically, a school district is at that max with their neighborhood schools. So typically, a charter school falls outside of that. But they surely can qualify for 60-40 if a district chooses to put that before their voters for that. Absolutely.
So basically, this for 3.5 years, charter schools can go in and get reimbursement for 70-30 for their construction, irregardless of the requirements of the 60-40 70-30 that's there now.
That seemed to be the intent, that they would have a lesser requirement to get that higher reimbursement. Okay.
My second question, was there, Representative Gannis, was there any discussion as you were talking about the tax credits of what sunsets do apply, or do any sunset apply to any of these tax credits?
There was very little talk about the tax credits and their effect because, again, we knew that it was coming up to finance and we were going to let you guys work on on the actual financial aspect of that. I think there was thought about what tax credits could and couldn't do as far as motivating, and but there was no talk about finances or sunsets.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Newman and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And welcome, Representative Gaddis, I think, or the Commissioner. I'm back on page 14, lines 19 through 27 again, section 18. And I was reading the summary of changes, and it talks about removing the sideboards around space requirements with the current debt reimbursement program. And I'll go back to a little bit of experience that I had with Susitna High School, and that they had a certain population or ADM that they expected to that school, and size requirements for a science class or a history class because they're different. Science classes takes different components. It costs more because the components in there. Does this remove all requirements as per the population of the school then so that they can build any size of school for the, or could it have that effect, that they could build any size of school for the amount of population for students that they have?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, that's basically correct. We currently have that in place. If a district wants to add a facility and be reimbursed at 60-40, they basically have that ability to do so without those space requirements. And this would allow charter schools to do the same. They're already allowed to do the same, but it would allow them to get reimbursed at the 70%.
Okay. I suspect we'll be looking at that further. So I'll go to page 2. Back to my notes here. For the, it talked about working with the keys, and I believe it, had my notes wrong here. With the application with the dual credits on that, for like the TVEPs and those types of programs, there was a requirement for, I believe right now, at least when I went to college for Pell Grants, that you had to keep a certain grade level, like a 0.2 or better, to be able to receive those. Is there any sideboards on the amount of funds that are available towards a student that go these? I think it went to, like, a student is what they're talking about here with some of the TVET funds or individual schools on that. Is there requirements that they have to keep certain grade requirements, or is it just...
To the chair, Representative Newman, you're on page 2.
Well, I was at page 2, and it kind of worked together the way I was trying to understand it here. The secondary school course credits that go towards them, that those credits, secondary school credits, I'll just ask it two separate questions. Is there ways that define any certain standards that a student has to have to receive those?
Through the chair, no. Now, these are basically testing out of a course that the school already offers. So I always use the example because it seems to make the most sense, a world language. We offer Spanish 1, and you have a Spanish-speaking student come in. Could that student test out and get credit for that, or are we going to make them sit through the class? But we don't step in and say, what does mastery look like? That's already done. A local district already determines what it takes to get a credit. And they would do so through a test as well as they do through sitting through the course.
Good. And then on, if I may, Mr. Chair, page 20. Starting on page 18, it talks again a little bit more about funding scholarships awarded by a nonprofit organization to a dual credit student. Does that allow students to go out and get dual credits, or I think that ties into some of the TVEP funds, if I'm looking right, that they can get credits on that, or is it just part of the education credits? I'm not sure.
Through the chair, this component are the tax credits, not directly connected to TVEP. And it recognizes that students to take a dual credit often have costs at the university level, whether it's for registration, course fees, lab fees, and there's been some additions added to there, like the transportation costs and things. So this simply recognizes the dual credit opportunities oftentimes come with a cost, and a tax credit could be offered to a corporation that wants to help to defray that cost. Slightly separate than the TVEP funds, which come before the TVEP components of the bill are, let me see if I can find a section to reference to you. maybe Section 21. The TVAP components simply state that if an entity is receiving TVAP money, that they need to offer dual credit, and they need to have an articulation agreement with the high school the student's coming from, so that that credit can be earned in high school and in college. So it simply adds a criteria. If you're going to get money for TVAP, you need to make sure our kids are having the right opportunities. That's the additional component that was added in this bill around the TVAP funds. It doesn't speak to grade points or grades. It just speaks to requiring an opportunity for a student to earn dual credit.
Okay. Just one more, Mr. Chair. And then, what I'm trying to understand also is the part on the tax credits. Section 26, they're repeated several ways under here, depending on where they're for. But it, like in Section 26, is the funding for a scholarship awarded by a nonprofit to a dual credit student. And then I'm looking at the summary of changes, and it says that the tax credits to that allows a nonprofit organization to fund a scholarship for a dual credit student. What I'm asking and trying to get to is does a student get a tax credit? Is a tax credit available to fund a student to go to dual credit programs?
To the chair, no. It would simply be, and I can simply give an example of a corporation that may that pays taxes. Mm-hmm. So an oil company says, look, I'm going to need to give so much money to the university to provide scholarships for students that are earning dual credits. They would then in turn, you know, file on their tax returns their credit for providing those funds, and the student will have the opportunity to receive a scholarship or defray some of those costs.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions on the education tax credit. It appears to apply just to a single student, and I'm wondering if that raises to the level of the tax credit that's on the books, which is, I think it's 50% of a $100,000 donation. Is really the intent here to fund the scholarship program and not just the individual student? If you could answer that question first, and then I have a couple of more.
And that'll be kind of a combined answer, I believe. As to the intent, it is to provide scholarships or defray the cost of these dual credits for any students, although, and I'll let Commissioner Rodell speak more clearly to this, someone who's providing a scholarship fund could put parameters on that. Could say, for students in this area, I want to support these students, or I want to support students that are going to this institution. They have that ability, but the idea is that they're supporting student scholarships. And Commissioner Rodell can speak to how that works as a tax credit itself.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, again for the record, Angela Rodell, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. The intent is really to allow the scholarship program to be operated by the receiver of the donation. So the tax credit is really attached to the taxpayer, and they'll be making that determination as to what causes they give that money to and will qualify for a tax credit. So it really is not intended to attach to any specific student, but rather to a fund or a program. And as Commissioner Hanley said, the scholarship fund itself can put whatever restrictions it feels are necessary to successfully operate that.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And can I follow up, please? And then in terms of the ultimate flexibility given to the charter schools in hiring, I'm thinking of some schools that might have an alternative education program. Let's say a language immersion or, you know, native language instruction, and where the labor pool may be very specialized, and it may be very difficult to hire within the pool of labor within the district. Is there any flexibility in this legislation to allow charter schools to hire outside of the traditional labor force?
To the chair, Representative Munoz, there's not in this bill. It's come up in different conversations, And that is largely a conversation that takes place between the local union, the school district, and the charter school to find an agreement on how a charter school is staffed. But that wasn't addressed in this particular bill.
Okay. Let's see. And then I had just one other follow-up question. On the chartering organization, if you also put any thought into having an alternative organization other than the school district approve the charter, you know, say like an educational nonprofit, a university, et cetera.
Through the chair, yes, we have. Several states have done that. They're multiple authorizers is basically what they are called in different states. They are different entities. Sometimes you have a charter school board that authorizes and operates essentially a separate school district, not defined by geographic boundaries, but defined by their mission and their authorizer. So that is something that we've had conversations about, providing greater opportunities for charters, but is not included here.
Okay. Thank you. I think those are two areas we may want to look at.
And Mr. Chair, if I could speak to that, you know, those same conversations, and I've had a bill on multiple authorizers, and I'm not entirely sure that our committee is really ready for that, to really wrap themselves around potentially another school district, because I'll have to say that they pretty much got caught up on another school district and couldn't get past that, although we've had Native organizations and want to be a multiple authorizer. We've had we have charter schools that want to participate, and I think that's maybe some of the things that you were alluding to, that we have that I think they've got some really great programs, and I think that we may have will grow into that. I just think it was really difficult for folks to get around that, especially going through this omnibus bill. So, you know, we'll continue working on it through the end of session, but I agree with you that there does need to be some work there.
Thank you.
Commissioner, this is an omnibus bill. What do you think about credential-based licensing of teachers?
Let's say we have an
inability to keep teachers in rural Alaska. If somebody has worked for the Department of Fish and Game, has a master's degree in biology, pretty hard science-based ability, and knows a lot about science. Setting up in a truncated process where that person could get a license, and I know there's organizations and institutions, and some of them have initials that. I think that's anathema, but is that a possibility to solve some of our chronic shortages and ability? If somebody's already lived in rural Alaska as a fish or a game manager, mm-hmm. federal or state, is there their ability to already know what it is like to live in Tuntutuliak?
Okay. Chair Stoltz, absolutely. We had the AKT2 program, which simply did that. It was an alternate route to becoming a teacher. People who had a degree in another subject area could begin working in a school while getting their credentials and learning the art of teaching, if you will. I spent the last couple days with one of those that is currently down of in Whale Pass on Prince of Wales Island. It is a great example of what can happen. That it's not an inexpensive program. As a matter of fact, we had to drop it because of its expense, basically per individual. It's a great conversation to have. Not inexpensive, but powerful nonetheless.
It's not inexpensive. Is it expensive to bring up an enthusiastic but ill-equipped Californian and put them in Kakanak and not have an idea what they're getting into, as opposed to somebody who already knows what they're and at inexpensive? What's the cost of the kid to have somebody that is well with enthusiasm and goodwill and intentions, and as opposed to somebody who knows what they're doing? I just want to tell you, I've brought this up, and I've very condescendingly been patted on the head by, just metaphorically, by administrators, folks from your profession, and from the NEA said, well, you just don't understand the art of teaching, and I don't know. Does that mean they have to be indoctrinated before they're able to do that? I don't know what code that means, the art of teaching. And frankly, I've always been dumbfounded by the it's almost a rote opposition. It's an institutional opposition to even talking about that in the educational represented community. And I'd love to put this in this bill. It's an omnibus bill, and we're trying to fix problems. And why not give another tool into that toolbox? But you brought up you almost deflated me there when you brought up this art of teaching and I don't know. Sometimes I don't know whether that's a real term or if it's a load of crap people give you. You know, I guess I probably shouldn't have said that, but that's how I've sort of taken it in the past because other people have been less sincere than you.
Your point is well made, and I would not argue about the cost of teacher turnover, which is huge, and the alienation our students feel when they're not able to connect with teachers who turn over all the time. And we surely wouldn't resist that. There's a fiscal component to the state, but the fiscal component to districts is what is the difference. But we had great success in that. We were kind of forced to drop it due to cost, but we found it very powerful, and I surely wouldn't argue with the cost of teacher
turnover. I was just going to see if the NEA was listening as well. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had two questions that probably have to be brought back. Can we get a number of those that we are paying transportation for that are not being transported? Because I understand currently that with charter schools that we do pay transportation funding for them, but yet they are not transported. I would also like to know, and this is probably not a popular question, but we pay for transportation to the Catholic school in Fairbanks. And since public funds cannot go toward private institutions or here, a religious one, how that is possible to be able to do that. Not that I mean, if it works in and they're able to transport them, but as we're trying to talk about transportation, and then the other part of my question is, it is my understanding for the formula that goes into the to boroughs and cities that some of the boroughs and cities actually take an administrative fee from the formula that's going in. I haven't been able to verify that through all the districts, but that's something I never thought happened. I kind of thought that was just pass-through money that went to the school districts, and so I noticed it's not in here, and if they are taking fees, Mr. Chair, I think that should be zero because formula funding is supposed to go to our children, not to our boroughs. So I don't know whether they have to tell you about that or whether we need to call all the organized boroughs and cities and find that answer, or just put zero on the bill and they'll take care of it.
And Representative Wilson, when you talk about charter schools, would you like to add folks that are in lottery schools that require transportation by the parents as well?
Well, my understanding, at least our charter schools, we use a lottery to see who gets to go to the charter schools, and I don't know if Anchorage, if that's the same thing.
Schools.
But basically, anybody we're paying for transportation, but we're not transporting.
I just want to make sure we're inclusive. Is that your intent, not just charter schools?
Right. It's just if we're paying transportation funds and
for students who are not being transported.
Right. Students that are not being transported.
And I would assume the superintendents know who the boundary exempt students are, or the numbers anyway. But.
Yeah, Chair Stoltz, that's correct. They will know the number of students that they have in their alternative programs and their charter school programs that they offer transportation to or not. The language in this component speaks to charter schools, and charter schools are any alternative program. It could be alternative, called alternative. It could be optional. Could be charter. When you're not a typical neighborhood school, you enroll typically in a lottery process when you have more applicants than you do space. And actually, there's a lottery process for neighborhood schools who have space, but people want to come from outside the district. If you're limited on the number of space and a lot of people want to get in, you do a lottery process there as well. So the lottery process is just simply the way the schools are filled, in essence. We could ask. I will say that Representative Ledoux had her staff call to all the school districts that have charter schools, and I think there are five districts, and asked which ones provide transportation and which ones don't. Didn't ask to the extent that they do that. Anchorage said they didn't, and the others said they did. So Anchorage is the only one that said they didn't. And I don't believe, and haven't worked in Anchorage for a long time, I don't think they provide transportation to alternative schools either. I don't know that that's something that the state steps into, or if local parents say, why aren't I not getting transportation like other students in the school district?
I think the larger question, Commissioner, that Representative Wilson is asking, the school districts are receiving the allotment, and I think she wants to quantify what that is. Is
well,
that,
two things. On the transportation. Yeah, I don't problem. But on the transportation, I was amazed that we pay. I mean, this is not a charter or parents question. Why would the state pay for transportation for a student that we're not transporting? I mean, for me, that just makes absolutely no sense. And until recently did I realize that we, and I don't necessarily think, as our co-chair said, is that it's necessarily just charter schools. I think there may be other places that we're paying transportation funds. The state is. Federal government, they want to pay for anybody. I don't care. But the state is paying for transporting students, and we are not transporting them. That's wrong, in my opinion. And then if the boroughs and cities are taking formula money away at different rates, you know, and I don't know whether they're not, whether they are or not. It just seems to me the department should know that, because through the audit process somewhere you would think you'd have to claim that. And I've looked at some of the audits, and I couldn't figure out where it was, but I'm not an auditor. We might need to take it to Representative Thompson's wife instead. But, you know, if somebody's taking 20% out and somebody's taking 10 or 5, when we're are that could have another reason why those districts are short of funding. And so, again, it was just two things I never thought was happening, and then it was brought to my attention recently that you have that, plus when we're talking about the mandatory local tax, and I'm not talking about another bill, is that you can also use in-kind donations. It's not necessarily just financial donations. So there's a lot of things going on that most of us, I think, that was all money going into the districts. Of if our district's given $48 million, I thought we were actually giving $48 million, not part of that being in-kind donations for other things. So we're just trying to figure where the money's going and why we're giving to things that we're not doing.
And for my purposes, I can't speak for Representative Wilson, it's informational and to know about the disbursement, because it costs that school district just as much to transport a bus with 32 kids as 40 kids, but it does give us a better funding picture. Last thing I want the school districts to think is they're going to be penalized, but it's good for us to know all the pieces of funding, and that would be my motivation. And that's so Representative Guerra and then Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One on transportation and one they're competing high school qualifying exam test bills, so I just want to make sure I get your position if one of the other ones ends up passing. On that, the governor's proposal says you have to take the SAT, ACT, or work keys, and then eliminates the high school qualifying exam. But for somebody, but it doesn't require you get a particular score. Somebody might not be going to college. So what's And then some of the other bills just don't include that requirement, which I tend to agree with. So what is the purpose of making somebody take the ACT or SAT if you're not going to impose a score requirement? There were studies that say the SAT has very little bearing on what you do in college anyway. What's the point there if there's no score requirement? And then what's your view of if we pass a bill that doesn't require you to take one of those tests?
Through the chair, the goal of that is to move from a high-stakes test, which is the HSGQE, as you have to pass, move from passing to participating. And the idea is not to provide information or data for the state, but to provide data and information for that student, for that school, and for the parents as to their next steps. Currently, we require the work keys. By adding the SAT or ACT, they would have a choice between those three. So the idea is not only to provide them the information, but those are also three tools used to qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. And currently, if a student wants to qualify for the Performance Scholarship on the college route, they would have to pass the SAT or ACT and have to pay for it themselves. This would simply say, you get a choice of the tool you want to use, and we're going to pay for one administration of that tool.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Just on the SAT and ACT, though. Obviously, if you're going to college, you're going to try and get as good a score as you can. But if you're not going to college and you're requiring them to take the ACT or SAT, I mean, how are you going to get any benefit out of that for a student who says, well, I just have to sit there for it. I don't have to get any particular score. I mean, you already have the incentive for students who need that test for their next level of education. But for those who aren't going to go there, what's the point? I mean, aren't you just going to get a bunch of students who say, I don't need it, I'm just going to sit here and mark a bunch of answers, and you've just wasted my time?
Now, through the chair, without that option, students are simply required in 11th grade to take the work keys. That's what's currently in place, a requirement to take the work keys. So all students take the work keys. Maybe with, you know, for students who find value in it, they take it seriously. For students who don't, they don't. But that's where we are now. By adding the ACT or SAT, it allows them the choice of choosing a tool that they feel to be the most effective or most appropriate for their next path.
And then just on transportation, Mr. Chair.
Jim Guerra.
We have our current transportation formula. You've heard some questions about it. By adding transportation funding for charter school students, under the way the formula is written, that doesn't take away funding for other students, right? It's just an addition. Is that correct?
To the chair, yes. I think the addition of the language around transportation, even without that language, I think the current statute says that a charter school's budget should be not less than those funds generated by those students. I think it's already in there. I just think it's broad enough to where it's open to interpretation and not always included. So there's no additional funds going out, but we think that, and we've heard testimony from several school districts that say that part really won't impact us because we're already transporting our students.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chair. So if we add this provision, it's not going to dilute the money that goes to other students at all, just if I were to vote for that provision. Is that correct?
To the chair, if a district right now is not transporting students to their charter schools, they may find now a responsibility to do so, to treat their charter school students equitably. And if that's the case, they will see a responsibility to do so, and they may have to find the funds to do so. But what it's doing now is, if that's the case, there's a disparity right now between charter schools and their neighborhood schools. And if suddenly creating equity between those in regards to transportation causes them to shift some funds, that could take the place, or could take place, that funds would be shifted to provide equity.
The legislature is currently appropriating money for those charter school students on a pro rata basis.
Correct.
Or through the formula.
Through the formula.
Were there any other questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. I think just on the transportation one, since it was there 20-some years ago, back when my kids were riding school buses, one of the issues was overcrowding on the school buses. And I believe at the time, and maybe it was just a Matsu school district thing, but they allowed them like 20% more the bus. If the bus held 70, they'd allow them up to 20% more students on their bus, so about 84 students, which made it so that the school district had just a limited number of school buses. Is that still out there? I mean, are those regulations still out there? I mean, the problem was is there wasn't room on the school buses at the time.
To the chair, the safety requirements are still expected to be met, and I can't speak to specifically what they are, you know, fitting three on a seat or two on a seat, what those requirements are, but those decisions are made locally, and we surely expect at the state level that kid safety is still in mind, that they're not expected to be standing up or not in a seat.
And I'm just trying to, what is work keys? We keep hearing about work keys, and it's been a while since I've been into that, so I just don't know what work keys is, and how does it differ from Common Core or Alaska standards? I haven't seen, or maybe we'll learn that as we go through the process, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Representative, it's not connected to the Common Core or Alaska standards directly. It is has three components that really gives a student an indication of their aptitude on a particular career. So it's location of information, math application, and there's another one for information, understanding information, I believe. So there's three components, and they're all applications of knowledge. And from there, they'll also have a score sheet on what you could get, and they'll give you a certificate, but it'll then translate to these careers typically would if you have a score here, it typically indicates career paths in this way or this way. So as opposed to SAT and ACT, which is really geared more towards colleges and universities, this is more for employers towards career and career training.
Thank you. I think I wish I had that so I know what I want to be when I grow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a system in place to evaluate the efficiencies from one school district to another for pupil transportation? Is there a pupil mile or number of students on a bus per mile? Is that done? Because I'm under the impression that not all school districts are equal in how they transportation. Not all can be, but if there's an assessment on efficiencies.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there, the funding for transportation used to be done on a reimbursement basis, so based on routes that school districts had. And they would submit their routes, be reviewed by the department, and then reimbursed for those routes. It was a relatively cumbersome exercise. It also didn't incentivize efficiencies on those routes. And so many years ago, and I'm not exactly sure of the year it took place, it was changed. And we took those actual costs that districts had in their contracts with the idea that we're trying to keep them whole, and we decided we're going to fund them on a per-pupil basis. So we took that the cost of that transportation that was currently in their contracts and translated it, divided by the number of students they had, and now it's based on funding for how many students they have. So they have the same amount that they did. Now, granted, there have been increases since then to the pupil transportation, but although now it's funded by student, it was based on actual contracts and costs previously.
Okay, I think I've got that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Goddess, and I represent those ones with higher costs.
Yes.
I know we do. Well, I want to express my profound appreciation for Representative Gaddis, and I was thinking of people transportation, I was thinking of Carl Gatto because he was a sponsor of that bill. Representative Gaddis, for I'm sure she had more interesting things to do today and other fascinating committee assignments.
Not at all.
No, I appreciate that. I think you added a lot to this whole discussion and giving us the legislative history and your candor. It's appreciated.
Thank you.
And you're welcome to provide us assistance as you deem.
Well,
thanks.
At least you know.
We are going to spend multiple days working on this. I think we've had a pretty good summary of where we're at, and I know some of the issues that are going to be more contentious and more subject to debate. I'm throwing out some different ideas. So early in the process, I hope folk members will bring forward some of their ideas and hopes for the bill. I know some of them have already been expressed. So that... please communicate with both the sponsors, i.e. the governor, and Commissioner Hanley, primarily. I think he'll be the focal point for your other commissioners and the administration, and through myself and my staff. And we will, we will probably spend more time in committee on this than we do the gas line and other bills, because one is, I think we have the luxury of, not just the luxury, but I think the necessity to spend time here on the fiscal issues and how they intertie with everything else we're doing and hoping to do. So we will probably go beyond this week. I know our leadership probably has hopes to have it on the floor sooner, but I know the bills in the Finance Committee on the other body. I think we need to do our due diligence, and a lot of the important financial decisions have been deferred to this committee. So hopefully sometime next week we can we may not get to a consensus or unanimous, but hopefully we'll get to something that has support of the majority of the members of the committee. So that, I appreciate the questions and the points raised, and we will follow the process. And if you want to hear from other folks, we will certainly bring those back before us. Tomorrow night we will begin public testimony. We know what I suspect a lot of that will probably revolve around the fiscal suggestions.
for the bill is my guess, but never presuppose what the public's going to come up with. And we'll spend all the time necessary until we get through the people that have signed up tomorrow. With that, we will come back tomorrow morning at 8:30. It's our hope to be able to take care of House Bill 305 and 306 if we can get some things resolved on that. We'll see if there's will to move both those bills out. And we have a couple other bills hanging there, House Bill 140. We still have our so-called dude license bill for fishermen. We have bills we previously heard. We want to get some of those cleared out. These are all administrative things. I hope I'm not boring the commissioners. And with that, we stand in adjournment. See everybody in the morning.